Environment and Natural Resources Committee to order. Okay. Sorry for the slight delay, folks. There's a number of committees that were meeting at the same time, and we were trying to get out of some of those committees. We finally have a quorum. We're going to, we have the minutes. Minutes. What do I do with the minutes? Minutes from March 21st. Representative Kelleher moves the minutes from March 21st. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion of those minutes are adopted. A number of things to get through today, members, and the quicker we move, the more we can get done, and we've got quite a number of bills in our committee. So, and we've only got a few more days left that we can meet. That's why we're here tonight. We're going to start today with House File 2839. Representative Tinglestad moves House File 2839 to bring it before the committee. Be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And you do have a House research short subjects in your packet, and that is the straight pipe septic systems. And this is an issue that I've been working on here at the legislature for several years, and looking at some additional things that we need to look at in state law to help deal with the straight pipe systems. And especially at this year when we're looking at clean water legacy and other things with cleaning up our environment, I think it's good that we look at the straight pipe system. And as you can see, it's a fairly short bill, basically the bottom of page 2 there, that gives information about non-compliance. An inspector who discovers the existence shall issue a non-compliance notice, and details with that administrative penalty of $500 per month of non-compliance, and one half of the proceeds collected shall for the penalty order issued for violating this go back to the local unit of government with jurisdiction. So with that, Mr. Chair, I've got Senator Jungbauer, Mike Jungbauer, from my area of Anoka County, and he will...
Thank you, from my area.
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. It adjoins my district right across the street. And he would like to show a few pictures of things that he's seen through the years. He has a background in septic issues, so we thought it would be good to have some visuals for the committee. And I think, are they queued up? And
yes.
Senator, please state your name and who you represent, and give a brief, short history of what your line of work normally is. And we'd like to get through the bill quickly, so. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I am Senator Mike Jungbauer, Senate District 48. In my real life, if you will, I am a licensed septic designer, installer, inspector, hold a pollution control agency license, and have worked with wastewater treatment issues since 1967 with my father, so I've kind of come to see it all. I come before you as a keeper of the pictures. I am known around the country as a septic doctor, so I've kind of seen it all when it comes to wastewater things, but I thought it would be good to help Representative Tinglestad, who's carrying the House side of the bill, by bringing before you some pictures to really show you what straight pipes are. And a lot of people will tell you that straight pipes have existed for a lot of years and that they're not something new. But the picture before you today, if you'll make note, the nice white plastic pipe is a PVC Schedule 40 pipe that is a foam core pipe. This type of pipe has only been manufactured for around 8 years. So this straight pipe system that ostensibly have been outlawed in Minnesota for about 25 years or more is only about 8 years old. And as you can see, we caught this one right after they were doing some laundry. So it was a nice, good visual. I just wanted to show you a couple different pictures. These pictures, by the way, are all within the public right-of-way. I know there were some questions as to whether or not we're asking for ability to walk on private property, that sort of thing. There's arguably whether or not by today's statute and code, if we have the authority to tag, and these are known as imminent health threats, imminent public health threats. Counties and cities claim that we do not have, as licensed inspectors, the ability to walk onto a private property, which I would agree with, but if we see one of these, we don't have the ability to tag it unless we've been invited on the property. So what this is saying is if we're in the course of our other work, if we see one of these, that we would have the ability to write a non-compliance certificate, not to give us permission to go willy-nilly walking on private property and that sort of thing. All these pictures I'm going to show you today, and I only have six of them, these are all in public right-of-ways, and every one of them is within 100 yards of a stream or a river. So they're going right down the public ditches or right into the creeks. Some people that you'd always think are good neighbors, here you can see a nice little church out in the country here. Great neighbors. They probably don't even realize, for the most part, that they're doing this, but if you look upon closer inspection, you will see a nice 6-inch pipe coming out of the side of that ditch, and it's actually not a ditch, it is a creek, and a 6-inch pipe on Sunday morning when you're there at 8:30 when they're, you know, coming out of the first service and they start flushing, it goes right into the creek, directly above it. So some of our good neighbors probably don't realize exactly what kind of environmental harm going directly into our lakes, streams, and rivers. There's another good view of one that's about 25 feet away from a creek, a straight pipe, and you can see the sewage and sludge. One of our questions on the other side in the Senate was, how do you know these aren't just drain tiles coming out of the house? If you'll notice the type of sludge, and believe me, those of you that work around wastewater, and again, the bill is limited to only people that are licensed inspectors. So we're already trained in this. We know beyond any reasonable doubt this is sewage, this is raw sewage that you're flushing down your toilets. I like this one, and so it's where I'll actually end to keep it nice and short and simple. Some people that have these straight pipes, they know they have it, because people argue that a lot of people might not know. And in a lot of cases, and the PCA can testify to this, you have drain tile systems within farmland. And a lot of people have actually trenched their straight pipe right over that drain tile so you don't see it. So those would be very difficult to determine where they're coming from. You might find it in the outlet of that drain tile, but you might not be able to determine where it's actually hooked. What we really want to get at is things like this that are egregious. This is in the county right away again. And what people have done here is, as you see all this nice piled grass and reeds and stuff, this is insulated for winter. This person knows they have a straight pipe and they don't want it to freeze up in winter. They want to be able to keep flushing. And within about a 3-mile area, I found everything from mattresses to uniquely made up shelter houses in the county ditching system to keep these straight pipes from freezing. So are people aware they have them? Yes. And in fact, they try to insulate them so they don't have a problem in winter.
Senator, are these in our district?
These are not in our district, Mr. Chair. For the most part, the 11 county metro area has done a very good job of cleaning up straight pipes. I have done septic since 1967, as I indicated. There used to be a lot of them in and around the Coon Lake area in our district. And as a matter of fact, we didn't physically install straight pipes. We installed a lot of open bottom tanks in the water table around the lake area. It was okay back in those days. And I have learned a lot over the years. And because of doing all the wrong things, I have learned what is right, what is wrong. But it's more outstate, and you typically find more of the straight pipes in the heavier soils and things.
Very good. Questions for the Senator? Representative Westrum, would you like to move the A1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I would.
Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, and maybe this is just comfort language, because according to the Senator, the language of the bill is only limited to probable cause, or if they see it, they can go on the property. But this would clarify that there's got to be probable cause so somebody isn't just wandering around property out there without any reason to be there. That's pretty much the amendment.
Very good. Representative Dingelstad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Representative Westrum bringing this forward. It looks like a good amendment, and I hope the committee approves it.
Very good. Any further questions for Representative Westrum? Seeing none, Representative Westrum moves the A1 amendment. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Westrum.
Just to follow up, so the Senator, Representative Tingle, so is it only lakes and rivers, or... And Mr. Youngbauer, maybe Senator Youngbauer, maybe you could enlighten me, but if it's a situation situation where it's a straight pipe into the woods where it's all grass and heavy soils, what is the harm in that scenario when it's not going right into a river or stream? And secondly, the ones you were showing with straight pipes coming out into public right away, it seems to me we don't even need this bill for those, because you could have, somebody could have already legally walked up to them and found them in the first place, couldn't they?
Mr. Chair, if I could answer half of that, and then perhaps Senator Dunbar the second half. If members want to look at line 2.22, it does say directly into a lake, stream, drainage system, or ground surface. So I think that answers part of your question, and then maybe Senator Dunbar.
What is ground surface, Representative Finkelstein?
I'm sorry, Representative Western, what was that?
What is ground surface? Is that surface water, Senator?
Maybe you can answer that a little better.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Westrom. It would be any straight pipe that discharges exactly the way you're saying. If it discharges on top of the ground, that has been illegal for at least 25 years. We've never had any teeth into our code or statute. It's the code is Chapter 7080. The statute is 11555. This gives us more teeth, and it gets into that effect that I talked about earlier, Representative, that it's always been arguable as to, as an inspector, you're typically invited on a property to inspect a property. Mm-hmm. And these ones that exit into the public right away, because nobody's been inspected on the or been invited on the property, even though it exits on the public right away, since you weren't invited on the property, you're ostensibly not allowed to go search out where the entry point of that exit pipe is.
I see.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Finkelstein.
I know there are a couple citizens here that would like to testify on this bill and probably want to hear from the PCA and maybe somebody else. Maybe not.
To them, Representative Finkelstein. Any further? Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Jungbauer. My question is, and I talked to my county inspectors this morning because I was wondering what happens if they do find non-compliant sewer system, but yet we're talking about people who may be living on fixed incomes, and they have to come up with the cash in 10 months. Can you tell me, are there programs out there right now that provide assistance to homeowners so that they could upgrade if they don't have the financial capability to afford it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Welty, if you look on line 225, it starts out, an inspector who discovers the existence of a straight pipe. The meaning behind the language, the reason it was drafted that way, is to give you somewhat like a policeman would have, is, and as Representative Westrom put in there, probable cause. But if you had a situation where you didn't think people could afford it, ostensibly you could look the other way, use discretion doing it. But yes, there are programs, Representative Welty, that are available. Should the Clean Water Legacy Bill pass this year, that would put more money into some of those programs, county grants, potential low-income loans. There is, and most of that money does go to outstate where the more of the poverty exists to do these things. The idea is not to put a burden on people, but the idea is these have been illegal for a long time, and if we're going to get a handle on our water, if we're going to look at the Clean Water Legacy, we really need to start with the basics, the things that we know are egregious and are directly discharging into our lakes, streams, and rivers. And as I mentioned earlier, most of these occur on heavier soils. So even if it exits on top of the ground, it tends to not absorb into the soil, or very little absorbs into the soil and then does directly run off. So even if you're thousands of feet away from a lake, stream, or river, it can carry a long way in a heavier soil.
Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a little bit of experience with this because I have a piece of property where there was a leaching system and it had to be replaced, and it's seasonal wreck, so it could be a holding and pump. In that situation, when you buy the property and it's determined that the system is non-compliant, you have to, I believe, in the county that we're in, has, I think it was a 90-day replacement of the system, and you had to go through approval. I just want to say that I think 10 months seems very reasonable here in terms of giving folks some time to, you know, get financing together or figure out what they can do. Because if you bought that property and it had to be inspected right now, you would probably have to go through a much faster turnaround. Just one quick question. Do you know the breakdown of these, and maybe the PCA can help us on the seasonal rec versus fully occupied? I suspect there might be some difference there, too. Or
Senator, Representative Stitt, do we have any information on that? Do you guys have that? Or maybe the MPCA might have something on that. Senator?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kelleher, the PCA does have some statistics. I'm not sure if they're broke down, but they're saying somewhere between 50,000 and 52,000 street pipes in Minnesota.
Okay. And do you don't have the breakdown, though?
I don't have the breakdown, but we could ask the PCA if we're
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Poppin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I just respond a little bit to Representative Welty's question. I know last year in the Ag and Environment Omnibus Bill, we actually did increase through the ISTS, we increased the amount that individuals could be able to borrow and the length of time they'd be able to borrow. So there's a little bit of an improvement there. I do have a question. I know that in my district I have at least one area where there are 16 people, 16 homes that live kind of, and collectively they've had a system that this is what it's doing, is putting it into just a creek area. And they have tried for a long time and in many ways trying to come up with ways to be able to resolve that and trying to get funding. They're low income. They're not able to each have their own individual sewage treatment system. They have to do a collective mine system. It's going to cost over $350,000 to do that. They don't have the funding. And I'm just a little concerned about how we can find these problems, but we might not be able to resolve the problem. And these people are well aware that they have an issue, and they've been working with the local extension agents, and they've been going through all of the different resources trying to figure out what they can do. So I guess I just have a concern about how will somebody like that or people in that kind of situation, they're trying. They're just not able to resolve it. So what would you say to that?
I think, Mr. Chair, Representative. The good news is there's a lot of new technology coming out almost on a daily basis in wastewater treatment. Now, arguably, some things that our pollution control agency would say is new technology has been around some 20 to 30 years. We just haven't had a way to introduce it into the state of Minnesota. So a lot of things that would require a mound system might not necessarily require a mound system under some of these new or alternative technologies. And that's really key. And when I do designs, a lot of people get answers and get fees and amounts, bids from different people. People like that, I would suggest get several different people to come out, take a look, and give them some ideas, because that sounds extremely high for 16 homes. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But again, there's not that many people that deal with that type of collection system. We've got some new rules coming up. The PCA could, again, address that for these collection systems, these community systems, that I think will be beneficial, and you'll see more people enter that market. And like anything else, economies of scale tend to drive the cost down. When you've got a very limited group of people bidding on something, that the costs come up pretty extremely high. So I'd be interested in pointing them in the right direction.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I think that also includes they need to purchase some additional property because they're doing the collective system. So they individually don't have the space in their own lot, so they're going to have to try to come up with another common lot that they can purchase. And so I guess I'd like to see this, because it seems to make a lot of sense, and certainly we need to just clean up our water, and this is a very basic way to do it. I'm just very concerned that there are many people out there that are in a similar situation, and they need to be financed in order to be able to do it.
Thank you, Representative Poppy. Members, Representative Kelleher, Mr. Helen has put this sheet in our packets. Very, very good piece of research that Mr. Hillen put together, and it answers a lot of the questions that you had, Representative Kelleher. Members, this is a piece of legislation that Representative Osmond knows that's been a burr under my saddle for a long time, and I think we need to adopt this and get this taken care of. At this time, I'd like to bring the MPCA up and get their perspective on this. And then we'll take any other comments from people that are for or against the bill in the audience. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you very much. My name is Gretchen Sable. I'm with the Pollution Control Agency, and I'm working in septic systems. I'm trying to think of where to start. Do you want to ask me questions first, since there was a bunch of questions, or should I spiel first? And
I'd give your perspective on the bill and how you feel about it, and if you're for it or against it or whatever.
Mr. Chair, we too are sick to death of straight pipe systems, and we want to see them addressed. We've been doing a bunch of things, working with communities and trying to move them along. We've been working through the PFA, Public Finance Authority, and finding the money. We use our enforcement authorities, which we already have, for these to move them along. We've had a problem, though, dealing with individual systems because they're regulated by local governments. And I think that this would provide some additional push to local governments to help move people along. Over on the Senate side, this bill was heard earlier today, and there was one small change that happened. In the House version, it would be on line 2.32. It's the sentence that starts, administrative penalty orders shall be issued for violations under this subdivision. That would require our agency to issue APOs for all these straight pipe systems. Current data shows there's around 50,000 of those, and that would be a large burden for us to do that. On the Senate side, I said that we should either give the local governments the authority to do APOs, which they've had in the past but no longer have for solid waste, or change that shall to may, so that we're able to use the authority then judiciously to work with local governments where needed. By doing that, that would address Representative Poppy's concern, too, of people that don't have the funding right now and aren't able to move ahead within 10 months, will need to move ahead, so that they won't necessarily be fined additional burden, but would be able to, you know, keep good progress and move ahead, and if they looked like they were lagging, then we could threaten them more. So that was... That was the change that was made, and that would be the change that I would suggest here.
Okay. Well, members, my perspective is on this that we need to have a tough bill, and especially going into maybe conference committee or something, maybe we can work out something different. But I'd rather not have it be made. I'd rather have it shall. And if we need to do something with administrative penalty orders through the cities or townships or counties or something like that, maybe we should do that. But I want to get tough on these folks that are doing this. We do a may, and we're not getting tough on them. I want the MPCA, I want the state of Minnesota, I want the counties, the cities, the local units of government to get tough on this issue. I mean, if we're going to do this, let's do it, and not push your foot around with it. What's wrong with you?
I'd like to agree with you and give an additional reason, if I could.
Sure.
An administrative penalty order does not necessarily mean that you fine somebody. It means you can fine them and say you get all your money back if you comply.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's misleading to think that we are going to fine everybody and that fine will stick. So as a carrot, an administrative penalty order is the best thing that can happen to somebody because it doesn't necessarily have to end up in a fine if they comply. So I am with the chair on this one. Keep it the way it is.
You know what? Control. Rip someone in.
March.
Stable. Any further discussion?
The chair.
Representative Bill.
Yeah, thank you. Sable, just looking at, of course, I want to be very proud of St. Louis Lake and Cook because obviously we're getting our act together up there, considering we have the cleanest water in the state. But I'm looking at Wright County and McLeod County, and I'm looking at 10,000 straight pipes on this document that Mr. Helen... But yet I look at the other counties, Anoka County, which is a huge county, has 20, Hennepin, 90. And look at those other counties around Scott, 76, Dakota, 40. Why would two counties in the metro area or near the metro area have 10,000 straight pipes and the other counties have virtually nothing in the comparison?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dill, this is based on 2001 data. And so I'll just say a little bit is that the septic program didn't even start until 97, 98, 99 was when local ordinances had to be in place. And so some counties were a little behind the ball. And so there was that. The other thing is that some are better at reporting than others. So, for example, Anoka County, this reflects the county numbers, but we have all those cities in Anoka County that actually regulate septic, and so this isn't the total load for Anoka County. This is, so there's some artifact kinds of things like that. Generally, since 2001, there has been some improvement. We require annual reporting from counties. I'm trying to find the numbers. So looking at the totals, in 2001, there was 63,000 straight pipes reported, and that number's come down to 52,000. So it's been decreasing over the years as things like property transfer upgrades and just general knowledge of sewage has been increasing.
It's
still a problem.
Well, that's comforting to know, but there's still too many. And
there are.
I mean, we just, in our community, we just spent $3-4 million sewering an entire community.
Mm-hmm.
That just totally ripped our community apart. I mean, it's like a war zone up there. I only go to Crane Lake in the dark, and I leave in the dark because I don't want to see anybody. But they can go to the bathroom now, and they can do it right. So that's a good thing. So I'm for the bill, and I'm with the chairman. I want it to be tough.
There you go. Any further discussion?
Sure.
That's
enough. Just to clarify, so, Gretchen, is there no fine if they cite you for out of compliance straight pipe? You've got 10 months to fix it, no penalty, and after that, you have to impose a $500 a month fine? Is that what it is?
Am I reading it? Ripson Western, you're talking about the bill?
The bill, yeah.
Ripson Penistack?
Maybe represent single sister better.
Or a senator?
Right, Mr. Chair, Ripson Western, it is on line 2.30,
mm-hmm.
About the, within 10 months. And then after you get past the 10-month time period, as it shows in lines 31 and 32 there, it's $500 per month for non-compliance.
So the first citation would be a warning ticket, in effect.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the way it was discussed in the Senate was that the ticker would start when you got the notice.
Very
and
good.
Then 10 months after that would be the deadline.
But you said in the Senate they modified the $500 fine to a may or up to?
Mr. Chair and Representative Westman, the way that it worked was on the Senate side, the bill retained that. Okay, it starts out, an inspector who discovers the existence of straight pipes shall issue a notice of noncompliance, and so that shall stood.
Mm-hmm.
The notice must state that the owner must replace or discontinue the system. That stood within 10 months.
Right.
The owner does not replace, then they're subject to a penalty. That stood. The only may that happened was whenever it came to the agency having to issue those administrative penalty orders for those 50,000 systems. That changed to a may. So that we could have the flexibility to work with local governments when they chose to have additional help. Counties actually have a fair amount of authority through other statutes, and that would be the health code statutes, imminent threats for public health through that,
mm-hmm.
where they can actually require an upgrade within 10 days, and some counties do that. This would help them deal with laggards. There was testimony on the Senate side of a laggard that they were having a difficult dealing with in Cass County. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to oppose you. I would agree with there was Representative Pappy. $500 a month could be an awfully stiff penalty in the wrong set of circumstances, and I wouldn't mind seeing a little more latitude given to the department to be able to negotiate this with the landowners. There's certainly a lot of older individuals that live in rural parts of my district and are likely are having straight pipes maybe into the woods or whatever, and lots of different circumstances that could result in not getting it done in 10 months. And I think this gives a tour. I think it does go maybe too far with the finding authority, because $500 a month in 6 months, you've got $3,000 racked up and under a long ways in the new sewer system. But won't go through that if it's in a fine. So, but that's my thoughts as you proceed ahead, Representative Tinglestad, Representative Heckler.
Thank you, Representative Westrom. I think we will be working on something in that regard, but I still want to keep this a tough bill, at least on the House side. If there's something we can change in that regard, I think we can do something like that. 10 months is a long time. to have somebody try to get a loan or get some help. And there are programs out there that we've passed in previous sessions that give counties some money for these kinds of things. There are options out there. And when these people are ticketed or warned or whatever, I'm sure they're going to be notified of those kinds of things that are available to them. Rep. Sabat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to testifiers, how long has it been illegal in the state of Minnesota to have straight pipe sewage disposal?
We did cover that, Representative Osment. What was it again? We talked about that.
Representative Osment, it's been illegal since the Clean Water Act passed decades ago.
In the 70s.
And then the state statute picked those up a little bit later. But the actual septic system regulations didn't start until the 90s.
Okay. And the reason I wanted to re-point that out is because some of us have had to replace two and three septic systems during that period of time, while others just kind of let it go out the back door.
Yeah.
I think it's about time we get tough.
Thank you. But Mr. Chair, Representative Osment, to that point, I can bring you the people that have had their septic systems replaced by licensed installers, and only to have the state change the laws in less than 10 years have to put a new septic system in too. So we don't always get it right here either. So, and those people were left holding the bag. So that's not fair either.
I can acknowledge that. I wish we could make certain that we're fair in all those points, but that doesn't excuse the types of illegal disposal that's going on.
That's in this bill.
That's correct.
Representative Lerner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I missed some of the testimony, but I was just noticing my county is 3,150, Otterfield County. I'm surprised at that number. And I also see that this information is about 5 years old. So hopefully that number has improved. And I also support getting tough. No problem with that. But again, I'm surprised because our county has a lot of sewer districts. We've got communities with up-to-date sewer treatment systems. I'm suspicious that my number, if it was updated, would be much better than that. So, and maybe the entire state, because again, this is not scientific. This inventory is just an estimate.
So
I'm hoping it's wrong, but we still need to work on it. So,
very good. Anybody else in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill as amended? Thank you, Ms. Sable. Good job. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Annalie Garlitz. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm a policy analyst. As everybody around the table has noted, we all want to get rid of straight pipe systems. This is a county priority as well to see these be eliminated from what's in the county right now. We just had some questions about the bill as written. We're unclear as to what sort of additional authority this gives to counties to go out and or inspectors to go out and ticket or issue certificates of noncompliance to these septic system owners. It's unclear of what this language does that kind of gives that extra push to this. Right now, counties under Statute 145A, under imminent public health threat, if they're notified of that imminent public health threat, they have 10 days to go out and Question Sable brought this up too. There's 10 days to go out and check this out and notify that person that they have 10 days to cease use of that. Maybe they pump their tank for the next 10 months or until they get that fixed. So that's something counties can do right now. And that was just a question that AMC had, was just what additions did this do, or is it just kind of restating what we already can do? In addition to all of the other issues that everybody brought up about the local politics and the local dollars that are available too, that will continue to be a problem. I don't know. Anyone has any questions?
Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Anyone else in the audience that would like to speak for or against? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and we will present for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark Hayes. I work for Minnesota Environmental Services. First, I'd like to thank the committee for holding the line on this bill. The only thing I'd like to add is I'd like to see it a whole lot tougher. I know I can't offer an amendment, but I'd like to give you a couple ideas. One, instead of just dealing with straight pipes, let's do imminent public health threats, period. Because a lot of times I go out to Lakeshore, I've been invited to do Lot B. I look to the right, Lot C, Lot A, two sewer streams going right to the lake. I can't touch them. I can't touch them. I can't say nothing about them. Period. Because I haven't been invited on the property. And yet, they'll be there for, you know, since I'm out in those around those lakes in my area, they'll be there for 5, 10, and I know some of them that have been there for longer than 15 years. The other thing is, you know, licensed inspectors. I would change that to licensed ISTS professionals. Because your pumpers and your maintainers are the ones who are out there who are going to find that.
Mr. Hayes, can't the pumper or one of those folks tell somebody? Can't they call the MPCA? With this bill, are they going to be able to do that? They would be able to tell them, an inspector in a particular city or township or county, that this is taking place and that somebody should go out there and inspect it.
Honestly, sir, the fact of the matter is they risk losing business if they do that, because there is nothing on the books that forces them to do that. So if the word gets around that you've got a pumper who's turning in every failing system or imminent public health threat, let's keep it at that, that they run across, they don't get no business no more. And Representative Dill, that list they had, were Wright, I'm from Wright County, that 10,000 number is the ones they know about. The number may be much higher, but that 10,000 is the ones they know about. That's all, sir.
Question. Representative Welty.
Well, to this point with the Westrom Amendment, when we adopted that, it says if inspector must have probable cause. If you are going out there and you're inspecting and you see it on the other property, wouldn't that give you probable cause?
Not the way that the industry operates. Maybe legally, but not by the way the industry operates. I could get into more trouble than it's worth, to tell you the truth. Yes, thank you. Senator Youngbauer reminded me of something since I seem to be a touch nervous. The bill deals with straight pipes right now. An imminent public health threat is wastewater running across the surface. They don't necessarily have to be out of, the pictures.
Well, Mr. Hayes, I think that's a bill for another day. Okay. We're dealing with straight pipes here today.
All right, that's fine.
That's something that you might want to bring forward as an association next year.
Okay.
Okay. Members, we've got a lot of issues to get through here tonight, and I thought maybe we'd spend maybe 20 minutes on this bill and bang it out of here. I think everybody's in agreement that we need to do this. Do we need any additional testimony? Anybody else in the audience that would want to speak for or against the bill? Come forward, please.
Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Do you have short testimony?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Bruce Schwichtenberg. I reside in Carver County. I'm coming from this from a different angle. I'm a person that's been affected by a situation where we have an imminent health threat in our backyard. I've got 5 girls. And it exists so that it's about 20 feet away from my house and 10 feet away from my well. And we've been dealing with the issue since 2002, trying to get Carver County to come out and actually do an inspection. And that hasn't happened yet. And, you know, I should probably preface this, but we are in a lawsuit right now dealing with Carver County and our neighbor, the neighboring system. And I'm encouraging you, like on the straight pipe, this is a great start. And Mr. Chairman, you had brought up about there's another law for another day. But please don't make this less tough. Because I know in Carver County, when they rewrote their ISTS ordinances, one of the things that they had in there was under the duties of the department, it used to be that the department shall be responsible for the enforcement and administration of this chapter. And they changed it to the department has the authority to administrate and enforce this check. And that, to me, said that they had the authority not to also, and that's what's happened in our situation. So I've distributed some information, too, that Representative Tanglestad could have if you had questions and pictures and stuff. So I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Please come forward. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Shermer. I'm legislative chair for the Contractors Association, which now has they've changed their name to the Minnesota Onsite. Excuse me here. It would be the Minnesota Onsite Wastewater Association. We're in favor of this, and we have eight people on our legislative committee, and one of the persons on there is a county inspector, and the administrative penalty order, and this was up in Cass County, they had a hard time. They had a case that went in through that penalty order, and they were not able to enforce it. It got upheld, and they weren't allowed to do that. So what they're doing is through citations. They're able to, the same as the sheriff, do a citation when something like this is happening. We are in favor of the idea. We need to take care of our imminent health threats. Right now, myself, I'm a designer, private inspector. So, we're hoping that this would maybe stiffen up for county and city inspectors, try to get more enforcement on that end. That's really all I have to say.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Let's see. Okay. Seeing no further discussion.
I'd like to renew my motion, Mr. Chair, as amended.
Representative Staff renews her motion that House File 2839 be recommended to pass as amended and be placed on the general register. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The bill is passed and placed on the general register.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Tingle Staff. Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Let's see. Yeah, we'll do House File 3200. This is a Hackbarth bill. DNR technical bill. DNR folks here? Present the bill. Mr. Meyer, are you ready? Short and sweet and to the point. And
Mr. Chair, members.
Just get the right bill here.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, and we'll present our bill.
For the record, members, Bob Meyer, Director of Legislative Affairs, Department of Natural Resources. Bill before you today, House File 3200, is the Department of Natural Resources technical bill. Section 1, you see we're striking the word grant out of Subdivision 1. And basically what the bill does, it creates a Subdivision 2 for grants. This provides clarification for our staff as we're writing these contracts and grants to be able to cite the specific section of law. We've had a couple of issues where become confusing, so the grants and contracts are separated now in a new subdivision. Section 2 deals with our wild rice management account. We're clarifying some ELS language. You'll see we're striking on 2.16 language and inserting that in a new subdivision 3. That same language is also inserted in several other ELS sections of the bill. Section 3, as I just mentioned, snowmobile sticker electronic licensing section, we're clarifying where the revenues go. It's the same language we're striking and then reinserting after in the bottom of that section. Section 4 of the bill is a technical change coming from Ecological Services dealing with invasive species. We're striking the words can naturalize and off of lines 3.8. Section 5, we're changing an invasive on 3.14 and 3.15 to a non-native. We've been dealing with these changes for the past several sessions. It's another piece that we've noticed or picked up between last session and this session. Section 6 does the same thing in Subdivision 15 of 84D.01. Section 7 of the bill, we're taking the word unintentional out of transport or the definition of transport, and it's changing it to re-transportate. Transport does not include the transport of infested water or dealing with the transportation of infested waters from one body to the next one. Section 8 of the bill also comes from Ecological Services. We're adding the words curly leaf pondweed or the species curly leaf pondweed to the definition of invasives. was brought to us from some stakeholders that wanted to make sure that it was in there and included in that definition. Moving on to page 4 of 4.8, we also insert that clearly leaf pondweed language there. Sections 9, 10, 11, and 12 of the bill are technical changes to the statutes that were established when these trails were put into law. As we create new state trails, we often have a general idea of where these trails are going to, where they're going to start and where they're going to end. Doing some work on a trail last year with a bonding bill issue, we realized that we didn't have the authority to put a segment of that trail in, so we corrected that in some language last year. Upon further review, we've identified these other pieces of the different trails that needed to be clarified. Section 9, beginning on 4.15, deals with the Glacial Lakes Trail, adding the word Stearns in there. And then 4.2, we clarify where the segment begins. Segment shall be established beginning in the city of Willmar, Caneohi County, and extending northeasterly into Stearns County. Section 10 deals with another technical change to the Brooklands Trail System, adding Rochester. Section 11, we're trying to clarify some specific language that was there about the trail, and just saying the trail shall originate in Mankato, moving in a northeasterly direction on or along railroad right-of-way into Rice County. Section 12, you'll see we're clarifying the Willard-Munger Trail, striking Ramsey, Anoka, and Washington. The trail was, upon initiation, was thought it was going to go there. After development, it was determined it's not there right now, and it will not be going into those counties, so we wanted to clear that up. You can see we define it as three segments, one that originates in Chisago County and extends into Duluth and St. Louis County, one segment that originates in Hinckley and Pine County and extends through Moose Lake and Carlton County to Duluth and St. Louis County, and one segment that originates in Carlton County at Carlton and extends through Renshaw to the Minnesota-Wisconsin border. We'd further go on to define that additional segments shall be established that extend the Willard-Munger Trail to include Proctor, Duluth, and Hermantown. Just trying to get it all on the record, Mr. Chair. Section 13, we're clarifying that ELS language again. Section 14, we're straightening out the definition of enforcement officer, striking the words or game refuge manager. These terms don't apply to the 97A, B, or C statutes. Section 15, there's a lot of language there. If you turn to page 8, actually, this is some language that came to us as we were establishing this water use permit for the... It's a water appropriation fee that was established last session. We missed it in the development of the special session bill. And Section 16 is clarifying a situation for aeration system public permits or public waters without access and aeration permits that are there. Just making sure that it's very clear how those operate. And then,
what are we repealing at the end?
No, I don't have that right here in front of me. It's a previous aeration provision that we're replacing. If you look at the 106G, Section 16 of the bill is the new language we're inserting. We're repealing the old language with that repealer.
Very good.
Sorry for the confusion.
Good job. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On pages 2, 3, and 6, dealing with the electronic licensing, I want to know a percent for the commission, the licensing commission, where does it go? And I assume it's to the DNR because you have later about a dollar fee for the one who has the machine. And then what's the average amount that you would take in, either over, that was the only two places I found it, or you can take each one, whatever's quicker.
Mr. Chair, each one of these sections, it's the same fee. For every ELS license transaction that occurs, there's approximately $1.50 fee that is associated with that transaction. It's deposited into the ELS account, ELS transaction account, and it's used to pay for the system, the computerized records. It actually goes to the vendor. for the operation. So it's the same amount in each one of these licenses that are there?
I don't, there is one of them, and I'll find it really quick. One of them says that $1, of the fee collected, $1 is retained. This is on page 6. Line 611, the fee amount collected under paragraph A, $1 shall be retained by the permit agent as the commission for issuing electronic permits. And maybe that's constant over all of them. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fennis, that's language that we created when we established the burning permit. The $1 that you mentioned, the first one of the fee collected, the fire wardens actually get to keep that dollar. So the fire wardens in your district, they keep the dollar. The other dollar goes to
That's okay.
Yeah, do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember.
Okay. There's an A1 amendment. There's actually a Representative Dill amendment. Members, this is a good time to mention this. When we turn in amendments to the committee, please sign your amendments. We want to have our amendments signed so we know. It's easier to keep track of what's going on. I'd really like people to sign their amendments. So my name's on here, and I'm co-authoring it with Representative Dill. Representative Dill, the A1 amendment. Representative Dill moves the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment establishes the fee for the one-year sticker. We're talking about the snowmobile trail sticker that we passed last year into law, in which the money goes to the grant aid account, which goes to, then is designated for maintenance and grooming, et cetera, of just club trails, not state trails, state-maintained trails. So line 1.19 and 1.10 establishes the $15, clarifies the $15 sticker fee. Then down in the, it's at 1.21, it talks about a problem we had was that political subdivisions in the United States and other political subdivisions had to have a sticker, and we're exempting them from that. So the DNR sleds had to buy stickers to ride on the trail. It's what we should be doing. Although, actually, I don't mind collecting the money back from them, actually, because it goes into the account. Actually, it felt pretty good. It also exempts a collector's snowmobile under the current section. And also, another problem that occurred over the course of the winter was that landowners who had granted permission to have a grant-made snowmobile go across their property were unable to ride the snowmobile on their own property without a sticker. Now, I don't know how many instances of this, but I had a fair number of complaints on this. Now, if they go off their property on a trail, they're going to have a sticker. But on their property, we're exempting them. It seems like just the right thing to do. And then the placement of the sticker has also become somewhat of an issue. Subdivision 2 talks about where it must be placed on the snowmobile. And the last issue, item 3, subdivision 2, the last issue, is dealer plates. A dealer can buy a dealer plate and clone that and put it on numerous snowmobiles for demonstration and testing. And they are out riding on the trails, and they should be buying a trail permit. And as it is, they would have to buy a trail permit and affix it on the sled. But now many of those sleds are then sold at a later date to a consumer who may not want a trail sticker on the sled at all, or may want it in a different place, or may want to do custom numbers, you know, integrating that in there. So what we've done is we've come up with the idea of putting the dealer trail sticker on the dealer registration plate, which they can move from sled to sled. This is a good, sensible amendment. I know Representative Hagbar supports it. We've worked with the department and Ms. Martinson of Trails and Waterways to get some of these clarifications done, and recommending it be adopted, and stand for any questions.
Mr. Meyer, you know, is okay with the amendment? Any problems?
Yes, we worked with
very good. Any questions on the amendment? Seeing no further discussion on the A1 amendment, all in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Dill. Good amendment.
Terrific.
Representative Welty moves the 1291 amendment, the A06 1291 amendment. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A06 amendment designates the Great River Ridge Trail as a state trail. We are currently not designated as a state trail, but I know if you go onto the Department of Natural Resources website, you can pull up state trails, you can pull up scenic and natural areas all around the state. what the this is coming forward on as the citizens have agreed to it that are a part of the and all of the members of the regional rail authority would like the trail designated as a state trail to really raise awareness of the trail in Wabasha County, and it extends into Olmsted County. The group is currently raising funds to complete the trail. We have 5.5 miles that are completed now. It's a beautiful trail, and once it is completed, it's going to be a great destination for the people in the state of Minnesota. So I would appreciate it if the committee would take this up and designate the Great River Ridge Trail as a state trail. And I went onto the website to look up the statute that this falls under, and we have over 20 trails designated as state trails in the state of Minnesota.
Very good. I would support the amendment. Mr. Meyer, are we okay with the amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, yeah, we did talk with Representative Welty about this amendment, Trails and Waterways.
Very good.
Okay.
Any further discussion? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anything, I know we have trails that are state trails and not state trails. Does that have long-term funding tails or implications on it becoming a state trail? Is there implications for us?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, that was our one concern that we did express, that is the funding issues that we'll have to come back with on this, and also there's a slight concern about what happens with the next trail once it becomes part of the state trail system, but it's something that we'll work with Representative Welty on.
Representative Welty.
And to address that point, Representative McNamara, if you look, as I look through the other trails, I don't believe that they have this language, and we put the language in there that says that the Commissioner of Natural Resources shall enter into an agreement with them to maintain and develop. The Department of Natural Resources could come back and say that we will not fund any of the maintenance of this trail, and that would have to be the agreement. So we're leaving the door open to the Department of Natural Resources to tell us if they want to help in the maintenance or not.
Ms. Meyer, do you see it that way?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members, as long as that's the understanding, we're fine with that.
Very good. That's the McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Moore, does it...
Meyer.
Meyer. It's been a long day. Wow. Mr. Meyer, sorry.
The boss is Moore.
Yeah. You know what I was talking to. Mr. Meyer, does this connect to other state trails?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I don't have the specific map in front of me. I think the intention is that it will become part of a larger trail network in the area. Yes.
Representative McNamara, Mr. Chair, the Great River Ridge Trail could possibly connect to the Chester Woods Trail. The Chester Woods Trail is currently designated as a state trail.
Thank you.
Okay. We might want to stay on top of this. The bill's going to the Finance Committee, and there might have some further discussion there, Representative Welty.
And Representative Hackforth, I'm happy to work with Representative Osment, yourself, and others to make sure that we get the, and Mr. Meyer, to make sure that we get the language.
Excellent.
That is fine.
Very, very good.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Welty moves the A06-1291 amendment. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Anything further? Any further discussion on the bill? Any further discussion? Anybody in the audience want to speak for or against? Very good. The chair renews his motion that House File 3200 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the Ag, Environment, and Natural Resource Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. The bill is passed to the Ag Finance Committee. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Representative Sikora, I mean, there she is. Welcome to the committee. The chair will move House File 3372. Bring the bill before us, huh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please present your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for hearing this bill. I know it's somewhat controversial, but I think when you understand what I'm trying to accomplish here, you will not think it's as controversial as you might think at the present time. It's something that we really are very willing to work on and talk about. I happen to live near Lake Minnetonka, unfortunately not on it. I wish I were lucky enough to live on it, but I don't think I could afford the property taxes. In the 30 years I've lived out there, though, the health of the lake has improved a great deal in appearance and clarity. So I have felt that we are really making progress out there. And a lot of citizens who are constantly testing the waters and that kind of thing. We have a Lake Minnetonka Homeowners Association that isn't very involved in all the issues that affect the lake. I am concerned about the invasive species. We have an incredible amount of milk oil. It's just kind of going crazy on our lake. We have harvesters who harvest the lake constantly, harvesting the milk oil and dumping it. Actually, Senator Olson volunteers some of her property for it to be dumped on. You know, it smells a little bit like silage when it gets dumped in those heaps. If you're farm people and you understand, it smells a little bit like silage.
What?
Hogs have boat propellers, all that good stuff. So I know what the goal is for us to accomplish here is I realize that the DNR is about to make new rules that will affect how we clean up our waters, and I'm a co-author on the Clean Water Legacy Act. But I think during this process, there ought to be the discussion on how we square the rights of property owners and what property owners will be allowed to do with what the efforts that are needed to clean up the lakes and the streams, etc. And so this is, you know, kind of an attempt to bring it to your attention, maybe, and get us talking about it. So I have with me a Mr. I. Cohen, and he will go ahead and talk about some of his concerns and some of the things in the bill.
Very good. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Bill Eichel. I'm Executive Director of Minnesotans for Healthy Lakes. I'm also a Homeowners Association President for Lake Emily in Shoreview. I'll refer to Minnesotans for Healthy Lakes with the abbreviation MHL. Save some time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Sikora and committee for allowing us time on your agenda. Our constituents are primarily lakeshore property owners across the state. MHL was formed by these property owners over the past couple of years due to concern over current practices regarding the management of aquatic vegetation and algae, but particularly the nuisance or invasive species. We believe that our current rules in this area are far too conservative. They don't allow us to treat aggressively enough to control this problem. We've held a number of meetings and a lot of correspondence with the DNR to understand their concerns and to express ours over the past several years. Actually, we talked with Representative Hackbarth starting a couple of years ago, and he encouraged us to attempt to do that, to try to work through the issues on a direct one-to-one basis. So we've done that with countless hours invested. When the proposed rules were revealed in December of 2005, the new rules that are being processed at this time, we learned that none of the provisions that were presented by MHL and other lakeshore constituents were incorporated. So after several years of discussion, we see nothing that we've asked for has been included in the proposed rules. We turned to our constituents and asked them for their opinion. The stack of paper on your left, my right on the floor, are petitions that have been flowing in from lakeshore property owners across the state standing in opposition to these rule changes. There are about 1,200 or 1,300 so far, and the number is climbing daily. Lakeshore property owners stand against these proposed rule changes. The new rules started to be applied in 2004 and 2005 field season, even though the changes have not gone in through the rule changing process, which, as I said, did not start officially until December of 2005. I have a number of over 100 as a sample permit reductions and rejections that homeowners have received in which the new rules are being applied. A homeowner asked for 90 feet of shoreline footage to be treated, and the rejection says no, we'll only allow you 45. Historically, the rule has been up to 100 feet of shoreline footage or the width of the property owner shoreline, whichever is less. So even though those rules are not yet, in fact, they are being applied. We believe that these rules, this is a particularly onerous area, provide far too much protection to invasive species, thus allowing them to continue to spread across Minnesota Lakes. Does that photograph show up?
No.
It does not. All right. Can I have a page, please?
Some water.
I see water. Who's that?
There you go.
Okay. These photographs were taken last... Minnetonka, which Representative Sikora was just discussing. That debris hanging from that trailer is Eurasian water milfoil. Again, our point is that we have not attacked this problem aggressively enough. Milfoil first appeared in Minnesota lakes 18 years ago. Today it infests about 175 lakes, and it's growing every year. Curly leaf pondweed infests 750 Minnesota lakes and is growing every year. Our particular concern is that these invasive species are being given exactly the same protection as native species, and we strongly disagree with that position. We have a concern that by tightening down on the shoreline regulations, that it's going to encourage what we refer to as vigilantes. That is, homeowners that take things into their own hands and use non-permitted, non-regulated products to attempt to control the weeds on their shoreline. And we are totally against that. But as the legal process gets tighter and tighter and tighter, I believe we're going to encourage that, and that's a problem for all of us. We also have a concern that these new, more restrictive rules are going to require a higher level of DNR manpower and woman power to enforce and inspect. While the threat of new invasive species, a la zebra mussels and the next generation of milfoil, are not being aggressively addressed to forestall them becoming as bad a nuisance and danger. And again, it's a matter of productivity of the DNR. We're saying we have a limited staff there. We would like to see them applied where it provides the greatest protection to our lakes and not micromanaging 30 feet here and 20 feet there. We do not agree that that's the solution to the problem. We're appealing to our state legislators to represent the interests of Minnesota lakeshore property owners to enable them to maintain their shorelines in a clean and healthy state. A fair balance between the interests of the general public and lakeshore property owners is requested. We strongly feel that property values are at stake. In addition, we're asking our legislators to require future proposed rule changes to have greater legislative oversight. We believe rules can be changed too easily without our legislators having a voice in the matter. Mr. Chair, that's all I have by way of prepared comments.
Very good. Questions? Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm somewhat confused here. I am looking at 3372, and it is regulating submerged vegetation and aquatic plants, but it's not restricted at all to invasive species, and all the testimony is on invasive species, which are two entirely different things. So when I read this, I was reading submerged, all submerged vegetation and all aquatic plants.
The issue of natives, we are, let me see if I can find that for you quickly, Representative and Mr. Chairman.
Well, I'm looking on at line 1.12, for example, mm-hmm. but we can also look at 2.11 or 2.25.
All right. Thank you. The existing rule is 100 feet of shoreline. That's allowed and has been the rule of thumb for 30 or 35 years. And essentially what we are asking is that rule be left alone. That applies to natives, and it currently applies to invasives as well. As I said earlier, we provide the same protection. So in the case of natives, we are asking that we leave the rule alone that has provided reasonably good success and homeowners have been accepting of and satisfied with for a long time. We have not seen any scientific data and have been able, unable to obtain any, that legitimizes tightening it down to one-half the property owner's shoreline, which the new rules do. So in the case of natives, we're not asking for any change in current rules, but we are asking that we not make them more restrictive. In the case of invasives, this gets back to 2.6. I should mention that you really have three lines of defense in terms of treating any aquatic vegetation and algae. You have, first of all, the shoreline footage that is allowed by permit on a lot-by-lot-by-lot basis. You secondly have the littoral limit, that is, the portion of the lake under 15 feet of depth. You cannot treat weeds, native or invasive, to more than 15% of that shallow area. And then there's a third defense, and that is that no treatment at all can occur on undeveloped shoreline. So only properties that have been developed can even apply for a permit, and then they have the other remaining double standards, limited shoreline footage and maximum littoral area. So when we come over to 2.6, we are asking that in the case of non-native invasive species, that property owners be allowed to treat those without limits, without the littoral limit. We understand, for example, in Michigan, for invasive species, lakes are allowed to treat 75% of the littoral area. We are bound by the same 15% on invasives that was developed 35 years ago for natives, and we have not been able to obtain any scientific evidence to support that same level of protection for invasives. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Not really.
Okay.
Not really. I think we're just going to have to hear a bit from DNR because this is a extraordinarily broad. When I read the words here, it's extraordinarily broad.
Is this the time for other questions, Mr. Chair? Or?
Absolutely, Representative Rodriguez. We are going to be bringing some folks up that are in opposition, okay, including the DNR.
Well, my big question here is there is no permission from other riparian owners involved in here. So one person wants to exercise some property rights that may harm another riparian's property rights, and that's troubling to me because there's nothing in here that says you have to get permission from all of the other riparian owners. Did you intend that to be in here?
Well, I guess I'm not sure how you say if one person is going to clean up the beach in front of them, how does that hurt the person next to them? Especially since sometimes there's open space or, you know, a lot of trees and shrubs and junk in between that would provide some kind of a barrier. And then the other thing is, many times many of the lake owners get together and, you know, work together and try to get a permit to clean up an area, like to treat milfoil in a bay or something like that, and they are willing to pay for it and either do the treatment themselves or pay for the way it's treated.
Representative Guinness, I'm going to let you continue, but I think we need to bring some of the other folks down and might clear up some of these questions. But Representative Guinness.
All right. But again, you are testifying to an invasive, but the language is for submerged vegetation and aquatic plants. And the thing that I can see that if some of these, and they're non-invasive, they're just submerged vegetation, that is spawning ground for fish. And so if you are taking all of that away, and this is a lake where people like to fish, you've taken away part of their spawning ground. And in that respect, you may be taking away the property rights of some of your neighbors, the riparian rights, because that's an issue that this committee has to really deal with a lot. The riparian owners, and everyone has the same ownership right, and one person cannot take another's inadvertently. That's a problem here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's precisely the kind of discussion we need to have, because we have to figure out, you know, what can people do, because people are beginning to wonder, you know, what can they do for some now they can have, you know, just a little narrow strip so they can get their boat to the lake, for instance. So the question is, when you own property, and unfortunately, Lake Minnetonka is, you know, there's a lot of lake shore, and it's very, very expensive. So people assume when they buy a lake, pardon me, when they buy a house on a lake, that they're actually going to be able to use the shoreline in some way that they can, you know, the kids can play there, or they can take a boat out or something like that. And I think people need to understand what they can and cannot do. I think it's important. You know, I'm not suggesting anything to damage the lake. I don't want to do that either. I consider myself an environmentalist. But I think there has to be some understanding of what are the rights of people who own it and pay for the building and pay for the property taxes and keep it clean and neat and try to, you know, try to take care of their lake as opposed to the rules that the DNR wants to make to supposedly protect everybody. We have to find some way to deal with that. And it's not going to get easier.
I think at this time we'll bring folks from the DNR down to answer some questions. Welcome to the committee. Do we have a real long presentation? Do you have a presentation from the DNR, or are we going to, I guess, just going to answer some questions that we may have? What's your plan? Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, Steve Hirsch, DNR Ecological Services. I did have a presentation. It takes me about 10 minutes.
I'd rather not go through that. We've got a lot of things to get through tonight, particularly the game and fish bill for the DNR department bill. Would you stand for questions?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to clarify one of the points.
Absolutely, please go ahead.
I wanted to start off, and that was with Mr. Chair.
Deputy Commissioner Holston.
Deputy Commissioner Holston, Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair, I know the committee is pressed for time, but I can't press upon the committee enough of how serious of an issue this is, and how important this bill is. We have a 10-minute presentation just to go through some of the impacts that what you're talking about. I think it might be valuable to this committee.
Deputy Commissioner Holston, it is a very important issue. It's a very important issue to me, and I like the testifier said, Minnesotans for Healthy Lakes, I've been dealing with those folks for a while, and I am sympathetic to some of their issues. And well, we might as well get down to the brass tacks of it. I think this House Bill 4496 goes way too far. But I also think that there has to be some middle ground met here. And I'm wondering that if we could have after deadlines a committee hearing on this issue and go through some of those things, if that would be amenable to the commissioner. Representative Wagenius, what do you think of that?
Mr. Chairman, there are ecological issues and fish issues, but there's some legal issues here that I think are extraordinarily important, and we have to be very careful of those legal issues, particularly in a year that we're talking about eminent domain, and I see some eminent domain issues here and some consequences for that. And I do think we need to talk about those, and that is a long conversation.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Wagenius, I agree with you, and there's some things that I would really like to talk to the DNR about as far as some of the chemicals that they can use. I think some more of those things should be available. I think the DNR should loosen up on some of those kinds of things. I think there's got to be, like I said before, simply there's got to be some middle ground somewhere on this issue, and I think it needs to be addressed, and maybe we can address it next year when we've got more time, but this year, after deadlines, I would like to have a committee hearing on this. So with that, Representative Cora, if it's okay with you, I would like to lay House File 3372 aside and possibly for consideration at a later time, and maybe after deadlines we can have another committee hearing on this. Is that okay with Bass Federation folks too?
Yes, sir.
That's fine. Very, thank you, Mr.
Very good. Thank you very much. I lay House File 3372 aside. With that, we're going to bring up House File 3496. Everything okay? The chair will move House File 3496 to bring it before the committee. I would recommend that House File 3496 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. If the folks from Deer Creek and Raceway would like to come forward. Members, House File 3496 is a bill that was brought to me by Deer Creek Raceway, and the issue is this raceway was built, and we'll hear some testimony because I don't know the exact dates, but virtually all the racetracks in the state of Minnesota are kind of grandfathered in under this exemption of noise standards that is currently in statute. This particular racetrack was built after, apparently built after 1983, and we would like to bring that under the same heading as all other racetracks in the state of Minnesota. If there's any other racetracks that this is going to be involved, I haven't heard of those. Maybe the folks from Deer Creek can let us know about that. They might know that information. But that's why the bill's here, and I think they're having some problems out there, and we're going to hear about those today. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Randy Queensland. I'm one of the owners of Deer Creek Speedway. I do have a handout, Mr. Chairman. I have a Mr. Joe Brandenhoff with me to help explain some things as well. I have a short version about our speedway. Would that be okay to explain at your time? Okay.
Want to take that on?
Nope.
Very good. I like short.
There we go.
Short point.
My family and myself purchased Speedway in 2001. It's about a 60-acre facility located about 50 miles south of Rochester, Minnesota on U.S. Highway 63. That's kind of the first page or two. On the third page of the handout gives you an overview of our facility from different directions. You can see it's got a real setting. It's primarily in the country. Smallest town's about 3.5 miles away, and then another one about 6 miles away. When we purchased it, we had went through the county and checked. We felt it was properly zoned. Matter of fact, had been a considerable while prior to us buying the property. We thought it was located where we would be able to operate it without any problems. The next page is a summary of an economic impact study we've done. It's got some bullet numbers in there for you to review. We do have a detailed packet if you'd like a copy of it. We have a gentleman here today that can speak on that if you would like. The following page is a plan we worked very closely with our county in 2005 to implement items to be a good neighbor in our area. It's very important to us to be a good neighbor in regards to operate the facility in respect of our sponsors and fans. We also work very closely with Minnesota Pollution Control in regards to a waste tire management program, a waste oil management program, and also on keeping the facility clean. We have a good relationship with those people in those regards. The following page is a plan we're looking at implementing for 2006. It also will enforce the 205 items and add a few more. Along with that, item number 8 I'd like to highlight, and it's pictured on the final page, is a barrier wall we're looking at installing in the next 45 days to help reduce the noise problem towards the residential area that way. Mr. Chairman, that's the summary.
Very good. Mr. Queensland, when was the track built? The
track was first operated in 1995.
Very good. Questions? Mr. Potty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Because Poppy understands this is in your district.
It is in my district, actually. And I've met with Mr. Queensland as well as I've met with some of the neighbors, so I understand completely what the issues are that face us today. Could you just explain the kinds of cars that typically race and if those cars are different at your racetrack than they are at other racetracks throughout southern Minnesota?
We race primarily, our weekly classes are under a sanction called WSOTA. Four of our five classes are WSOTA sanctioned classes. WSOTA is in six states with, I think, approximately 20 of those tracks in the state of Minnesota, approximately. Is that right? And two provinces of Canada. These are identical cars run under the identical rules throughout the entire six states of WSOTA. We have one other class that is USRA Modified, which runs in all around southern Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. That one. So that's one class there and four other classes, similar to other tracks.
Representative Pop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that you are very involved in the racing industry. I'm not familiar with it. So can you tell me, do these cars, then, as far as the muffler use, are they with mufflers, without mufflers? And as you talked about the different kind of classes and the WSOTA kind of designation, do they, again, are they different from other, like, you have another racetrack in Lansing or in Dodge Center or Caston or any of those places. Do they use mufflers on your cars or not use them? And if you could just explain that a little bit more. Thank you.
Queensland, are there any auto races that use mufflers?
I'm not aware in our area of any that do. What we have is in our rule book, it has a decimal level reading. They have to be at 100 feet at certain RPMs. And that's in our rule book. I happen to be on a committee that was formed in November through our association, which I'm treasurer of, and on the committee to look into the noise level and reducing it throughout the entire organization to see if it's a problem or not. So I have to be on that to look into that. But they run the identical all over.
Can we have some popping?
Thank you. And another question about the sound barrier, because you have indicated that you're going to put up some sort of a wall or sort of some signage. Do you have an idea how that's going to impact the sound in the area? Do you have any kind of expectation that might reduce some of the sound?
Mr. Queensland?
Mr. Chairman, what I found talking with our noise expert we had look at it, he said there is no guarantee of exactly what it will do. He said the closer to your facility the track you put it is better, and he said there's no question it will do a very good improvement. You'll just have to basically wait and get it in and test it to really know the exact amount, is what he told us.
That's the problem.
Thank you. And then I have another question about, do you have any plans to do any other, I know you're doing it on the one side that I know some of the neighbors live on that side, so that they're concerned about it. Do you have any plans to do it anywhere else around the racetrack as far as putting up a wall?
Well, Mr. Chairman, what we found is when we have put up a couple of our structures to the west side, it on its own, we were told by people that it made a difference in their homes a ways away. They weren't complaining anyway. They just said, it's quieter now. What did you do? And the only thing we have done was construct our two new buildings there along there. So we fear this barrier will take a good portion of the other side where it's towards residents. And between where the buildings are and where these will go, that covers primarily any residents that's very close at all that way.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Another question is just as far as I know that you're not the original owners of the racetrack, so this has kind of been a concern for the neighbors for the past 10 years. Can you tell me as far as the racetrack owners before you, if you know if you've done things differently than what they did, or how perhaps I know you've tried to be a good neighbor. I appreciate that. I know that the neighbors are still frustrated because it's a noisy backyard event for them. But I'm just wondering about, you know, the difference between you and past racetrack owners as far as the kinds of things that maybe you've done. I guess I didn't ask you that when I met with you, and I was just kind of curious about that.
Mr. Chairman, we run, basically the cars we run, with the exception of one class, are the same cars they ran then. the identical cars that were running back at the same time they owned it. I really don't know how they ran it differently in regards to this.
Thank you. And I don't know if you'll be able to answer this or if somebody else will, but the date of the 1996, it's clearly designed so that your track fits within this category. Do you know how many other tracks? And then also, why not 2006? Why not bring it up to today's dates if it seems to work up through 1996?
And Brandy, do you want to answer? Mr. Chairman, could I refer that to Mr. Brandenhoff?
Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair, Gerald Brandenhoff. I'm representing in a stand-in basis Mr. Queensland here today because his attorney had to leave. I happen to be a race fan of 50 years, but I also happen to be an attorney who has done work in the motorsports industry for the last 20 years. And Representative Poppe, I think I can respond to your questions directly. First, there are 34 racetracks in Minnesota. I have a handout. I just don't have enough copies. I didn't know how many of you are going to show up today. I think I have about a dozen. There are 34 racetracks in Minnesota. Of those 34, 12 are privately owned. 22 are located on public property, primarily fairgrounds, racetracks. Of those 34 racetracks, 31 of them were built or were in operation before July 1 of 1983, and therefore under the existing statute are exempt from the noise standards. Only three racetracks have been built since 1983. Those racetracks are I-94 Speedway in Sauk Center, I-94 Speedway in Fergus Falls, and Deer Creek Speedway in south of Rochester. Deer Creek Speedway was originally built by a gentleman by the name of Mr. Ferguson. He sold it to some people by the name of the Schuberts, who operated for a number of years, and then the Queenslands bought it. That racetrack has been sanctioned under the WSOTA sanctioning body for its entire existence. WSOTA has a rule, in effect, which is enforced that all cars racing in WSOTA must be equipped with a noise suppression device. It doesn't have to be a muffler. There are other ways to do that. That reduces the decibel level to no more than 100 decibels at 100 feet. That's a mandated rule. Most tracks do their own testing to make sure that they stay within that limit. The thrust of this legislation, I'm speaking on behalf of Randy's regular attorney, Jack Perry, here, the thrust of this legislation was to treat the three racetracks built after 1983 the same as the other 31 racetracks who currently enjoy an exemption from the noise standards. These three do not. They're only trying to bring them within that exemption. You could move it up to 2006, and in fact, if things are going the way I think they are, there's somebody who wants to build a racetrack up by Pine City, and they'd probably like to say that it should be 2006 or 2007. That isn't really the thrust. The other part of this bill, the central part of the bill exempts the, right now, even though 31 racetracks are currently exempt from the noise standard, they are not exempt from being sued civilly for nuisance or any other violations of state law. So it's a crazy thing where you're exempt from the noise standard, but you're still potentially liable for civil suit. And that's why that central provision is included in the bill. The last thing on the bill was relates to local control. I can assure you that I just recently talked with Craig Johnson of the League of Minnesota Cities. We are prepared to strike that part from the bill. And he said they are totally comfortable with that if that's the case. What this is really an effort to do is to try to treat all racetracks fairly. And we do not feel it makes sense to impose controls or standards at the state level, that racetracks can be very adequately controlled at the local level by local authorities and local units of government through ordinances and other measures, just like the other racetracks have done in Minnesota for years. I have visited or attended 16 of the 34 racetracks, and I'm familiar with all the rest. I was the legal counsel for WSOTA for 15 years. I am been involved in the motorsports industry and have been a consultant on noise issues to other tracks in Minnesota. Minnesota, Wisconsin, and other states, and I have been a panelist and a speaker at national conventions on a regular basis representing people in the motorsports industry, and this issue has been effectively dealt with around the country by local control, and we feel that this bill just makes all racetracks equal in the state of Minnesota, exempts them from civil suits for noise, all of them, not just Deer Creek, and leaves local control over the racetracks where it belongs.
Mr. Queensland, have you had a chance to discuss deleting the new language on line 22 in the bill that Mr. Brandon Hoff, is that what it was?
Brandon Hoff, yes, Mr. Chair.
Or with your attorney, Jack Curry.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we have, and we're in agreement with that.
You're in agreement with that. Okay, Representative Poppy, you have an amendment to delete that language?
Yes, I do.
Very good. Representative Poppy moves that amendment. All in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails, amendment is adopted. Representative McNamara?
I got it. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Very good. Further discussion? Representative Kelleher.
Can I ask a general question? And this is to the middle part of the bill, and I don't think if Representative Poppy and I know we're going to hear from some other folks who have concerns about the bill, but I'm a little bit concerned about the middle exemption and the civil lawsuit part, because am I reading this right? And I'm not an attorney, so I have to ask if that then applies to the whole piece before that, including highways, anything else that, you know, may violate standards. And I'm a little bit concerned that this is so widely drawn that...
Mr. Brandoff, how do you read that?
Well, if I were to offer an opinion, having to look at it for the first time here today and confronted with your question, Representative Keller, Mr. Chair, I would think that she's probably accurate in that it does appear to be rather broadly written, because I don't see any limiting language that says it is limited to subdivision parent 5 close parent, nor is it in any way couched or limited in any other respect. So yes, I would view it as broad. That would be my interpretation.
Any further discussion? Representative Kellner, I believe you're correct. I would like to straighten that out. This is not the civil law committee, and the bill is going to civil law.
Okay.
And I hope that I want to work on an amendment to straighten that out.
Great.
And limit it to the racetracks.
Okay.
If that's okay with you.
Well, and I'm just going to, on the racetrack issue, I'm going to defer to the folks who have to live with their neighbors on this, because I, you know, my concern in my community has always been noise along I-394, and sometimes that has been in violation of state standard, and there's been some issues with that, and I would really hate for us to take away everyone's legal recourse here on every single issue. And, you know, I think about this in terms of the University of Minnesota Stadium issue coming up, where right now they're going to seek permission from the city and other entities in terms of 12 outdoor events a year other than football. And boy, I mean, this has huge implications. So I understand what you're trying to do here, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I'm glad you're going to work on it, because I would have some very serious concerns about how broad this is.
Very good. I agree with you 100%. We'll try to limit it to just the racetrack issue. Okay. Perfect.
We have the opportunity to hear from some of the neighbors.
Oh, absolutely.
I just wanted to make a comment, because this is this does impact people that live in the area, and certainly it impacts economically, because the Queenslanders have owned this and put some money into it as well. But if I could, I would build an invisible wall around it, because I think that would be a way to kind of handle this. But unfortunately, I neither have the power nor the ability to do that. And so I just want to, I guess, assure the neighbors that I think that some local control, if then you'd have the opportunity to meet with the county board, and there's a county commissioner here, and he may testify as well. But I think that would be something that at least gives them some sense of a local connection, and hopefully the continued work of being a good neighbor will go on. So, thank you.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Queensland, how many in that picture I'm looking at, and it looks like a development in one direction or another where there's some residential housing, about how many, I'm trying to figure out how many people or how many houses are in there and what that really is in the corner. You see where the road... No, right in the houses. In that housing? That's a campground?
Ms. Queensland?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we have a campground adjoining it to the, what would be to the north, whatever picture you're looking at. We have a campground. If you look at the picture that says, looking south, the very bottom right corner,
yeah,
and you look at the track, that's our campground area in front of the track. And to the right is a ridge. Yes, there's a total of two homes across the road. One just got built here in the last couple, 3 years. Of those. It's all the homes that will probably ever be there. But in the other direction, there's 30 acres owned by the Ritt River Antique Polo Association, and they have an annual event out there, and they buffer it with 40 acres to the east of our facility. So we have no homes directly to the...
And that, Mr. Chair? That campground area, that's included in your facility,
yes,
then?
Yes, okay. Part of our 60 acres.
Yeah, those homes that are across the street in that big, heavily wooded area there? Do they have, is that where you're talking about, the homes that are across where that heavily wooded area is?
There's one in there.
Oh, okay. I just wondering, did any of those have kids, and do they work at your Seedway?
We have offered them tickets and offered them things, and they're very pleased. They're good neighbors. We have a good relationship with them.
Okay. I thought maybe that was a residential area, but it's a campground. Thank you.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, would the committee like a copy of my list of racetracks if they want it? I have about a dozen, and more can be made if you want.
Yeah, why don't the page grab that, and we'll pass those out to the members that are at the table. I mean, just to the members that are at the table. I think at this time we'll bring some other folks up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Good job. Stick close by. We might need you. Ray Tucker? Commissioner Tucker? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray Tucker, Mauer County Commissioner, and Deer Creek Speedway happens to be in my district. The problem we've had in the past with this, with the noise issue as far as the decibel per time of the day that it changes, sometimes they can meet that regulation, and the later in the evening they cannot. It's been the pretense from the commissioners that we would just as soon regulate this at the local level with time of operation, more so than micromanaging this decibel level.
And Commissioner Tucker, what do you have in mind, or what have the commissioners talked about doing as far as a curfew or whatever that might be? Because I do know that sometimes, you know, a race might start, or you're going to start a race, and maybe it rains or something, and there might be a delay, and then later on you might come back and say, well, let's start the race and try to get it done. Those are some of the problems that you're going to deal with when you decide to make your curfew. So what's the County Board of Commissioners talking about, or what are they thinking?
Well, we're thinking to keep it similar to other tracks. We've also investigated the other tracks that are running inside the state and looked at their ordinances and trying to duplicate, you know, weeding out the good and the bad. We're not going to reinvent the wheel here. Mm-hmm. The problem that we have with this site, as you can see, that original piece of property was a campground. At that time, was back in 79, 78, the county went ahead and zoned that commercial when we only had commercial, agricultural, and residential. We didn't distinguish between racetracks and so forth. Well, then when the track came about, our attorney advised us that as long as it was a commercial piece of property, it set the zoning for a racetrack. Well, that seems okay until we go to this statute with the noise limits. And that seems to be giving us the problem. As far as regulations, our county is not a bit afraid of passing ordinances to regulate people.
Very good. So you can, we change this law, then you'll be able to work with the racetrack owners and the county board to come up with a reasonable curfew.
Correct. We would work with all the citizens, hold the public hearings just like we normally would, and come up with a document to do. We have one other racetrack in this county, which is also to be noted, which is under the old law. So we have one racetrack that is not and one that is. We'd just as soon have an ordinance that covers racetracks, period.
Very good.
And they're both the same.
Excellent. Questions for the commissioner? Let's jump out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I appreciate that Commissioner Tucker coming up, and I have spoken with him about this because I think he also has been involved from the neighbor's perspective as well as from the Queensland's perspective to contact you, and I appreciate that you're coming forward today. You mentioned that you would have some public hearing and some comments, so you do see that as somewhat of a collaborative, process maybe to come up with some language that would meet the needs of the Queensland, the owners, as well as trying to reduce or do what you could to deal with the concerns from the neighbors. Is that correct?
Commissioner Tucker.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppy. The track, even the people that race at these tracks want to go home at night. So they're also regulated. We don't want this thing running late night, multiple days, and just doing whatever. We have to provide police protection, fire protection, so forth. We don't want all those people out there in the middle of the night. So we will regulate both racetracks the same.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I hope this doesn't catch you off guard when I ask you this question, but I'm going to ask, do you have a sense of the amount of economic impact that the Speedway has in the most recent years versus over the 10-year period?
Mr. Tucker, do you know anything about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppy, I really don't know the dollars and cents. I do know that I have had numerous calls from people that are in favor of the racetrack. I've had calls from people in opposition to the racetrack. I do believe that it should come back to the local level.
Very good. There is a chart in the handout that Deer Creek had, a summary of an economic impact statement, or economic impact report. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Harold Pearson? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
I'm Harold Peterson. I represent the Blooming Prairie Lions Club. The Blooming Prairie Lions Club, along with the Blooming Prairie JCs, previously have operated a charity race, automobile race. We'd operated for 25 years in the city of Owatonna at a county-owned racetrack. And we've run into problems there in terms of impact, and so we decided to move it to Deer Creek, a much better facility. In the past year at Deer Creek, we ran a race there, which brought in over 45 cars from over 20 states, fans from all those states as well, and we were talking about economic impact. All these people from outstate had to stay somewhere, and I'm sure they were staying somewhere in Maurer County. They used to stay in Steele County. So this impact is quite substantial. We had over 5,000 people at the race. The economic impact to Blooming Prairie is substantial as well. We get about $10,000 income from this race each year, which the Blooming Prairie Lions Club distributes to the nonprofits in our community. We get helpers from all of these nonprofits to come and work at concessions, work tickets, and work at other areas so that we can benefit from this race. And that's our sole interest in this, is making sure that Deer Creek, our new site, will be our site for quite a few years.
Very good. Questions for Mr. Peterson? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll bring up some other folks. People testifying in opposition, local residents, who would like to go first? Who'd like to come forward? Please come up. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and if you represent somebody or just a resident.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really nervous, though. I hope I don't babble too much.
Oh, no problem. Just take your time. It's all right.
My name is Debbie Gettleman. Actually, I represent...
Gettleman.
And I hope all of you have checked your emails, your faxes, and your phone messages, because we've been on the ball today and yesterday. We just found out about this meeting on Monday, so this has taken us by surprise, but not really. My husband and I live on an acreage 6 miles northeast or northwest of Spring Valley. We live about a half a mile off away from Deer Creek Speedway. This has been our home for the past 33 years. Our children were born and raised here, and we have hoped that our grandchildren could have fun or have the same enjoyment of playing in our large backyard as their parents did, but they can't. A track was built a less than a half a mile from us, and there's no way we can have family and friends over on any day, race day, due to the constant rumble of the stock cars going around the track. Many nights we can't hear our TV, even with the windows and doors closed. At times, the decibel level has exceeded the 90 mark. In the past, the races have lasted well past 10 p.m. and have gone up to 2 a.m. This means that our entire spring, summer, and fall, or part of the fall, I'm sorry, practice is ruined. Practices and races start the first week in April and are over the end of September, 1st of October. This is every weekend and many weeknights for 6 months that we have to endure the roaring of race cars. On any given race night, the races can be heard up to 10 miles away. Last year, the racetrack was cited for legal limits over, or every time they were monitored, they were cited for legal or limits over time that was measured. The Deer Creek Speedway was built in 1995. The legislation directly impacts this track. Our owners knew the noise standards when the track was built. Since they do not like the laws, now they want to change it. What other laws are they going to ask to change if this one passes? Even big businesses like the Minneapolis Airport have to comply with the noise standards. I believe that the racetrack is going to be putting up some sound barriers. If so, I would like to have the MPCA work with them to make sure that they are effective. The noise not only affects our home, there are over 20 homes within a 1 mile radius of Deer Creek Speedway. At least 9 children under the age of 10 live a half a mile from the track. If one of them would get hurt outside while these loud races are on, you couldn't hear their cries for help. No child should have to spend their summer evenings inside, much less have to leave their homes to escape the noise. We have asked several of our people that represent us, including Mr. Tucker, to come from the county or state to our home for one evening of the race, so that they could see firsthand of our concerns. Only Representative Poppy cared enough to come. When she was there, we had to yell at each other in the backyard. Please take into consideration all the families and homes that this will affect. It's not only my home, it is many, many more. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? What's up, Poppy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Debbie, for coming up today, because I think it is an important issue, and it certainly is something that I know as the neighbors, you certainly have been concerned about the noise. Can I just ask about any remedies that you've tried to seek from either the Queenslands or previous owners to the racetrack, and what kinds of remedies you could see actually working for you and your family and maybe some of the other neighbors?
Actually, the Queenslands don't speak. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. The Queenslands don't speak to us. We have asked. The only thing we've asked is the noise being with the legal limits. Everybody says time. If the time is okay, they get done at 10 o'clock. How can we have anything in our backyard? If they change this noise law, there's no way we can even be home. And why do I have to leave my home every night there's a race? I did give a handout to everyone. It tells you how many races there are. And this is not only Saturday night. There are races Thursday, Friday, Saturday. If they have a rain date, they go on Sunday. So it really affects a lot of people in our area with the noise situation. I believe I sent Mr. Heckbar an email stating that one of our neighbors, when they bought their home, they bought it in the off-season. They wanted a place out in the country to raise their children. They were told by the seller, oh, you can't hear the racetrack. Well, right now, you can stand on the other side of their house and their back door, and you cannot hear.
hear each other talk. So, yes, this is a strict concern of all of us that live there. And if we had had more time, there would have been more people here to testify.
Representative Poppy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any, what specifically do you think could be done or should be done that would help? I understand the sound barrier may be something that would help. Is there anything else that you would like to see happen?
Mr. Chairman and
Ms. Delma.
A sound barrier, what I believe is what they're going to put up. There are trees that are 20 some feet tall between us. There is a woods between us, mm-hmm. and we still get up to 90 decibels in our backyard.
Any further questions? Representative Norris?
Mr. Chair, I missed some of the testimony, so maybe this has been brought up. I'm just curious, what kind of cars are racing on this track?
I have no idea.
And are they Cleveland stock cars?
We'll get to that. We'll finish with this witness,
okay.
And then we'll come back
to that.
I was
just going to point out that Sauk Center has a racetrack basically in town. Alexandria has a racetrack in town. Curtis Falls has a racetrack in town. And I don't see any of those folks here. So I'm just wondering. I was just curious what was unique about this racetrack.
Mr. Chairman, to that effect, those people were told, and that's why a lot of people in our area quit talking about it, was they were told, you can't do anything about it, so quit calling. That is exactly the situation.
And that was told to you by who?
We were been told that we've been calling into the county sheriff's office. Actually, the last couple years, they've finally been coming out monitoring. But we would call in there and say, it's terrible noisy out here. We can't stand it. And they would say, well, there's nothing you can do about it. So many people do not even call anymore. And as for that, Mr. Cleveland told us, the one time he did speak to us, that if there's a problem, call us. You know, if we're having a problem here, call us. Well, one night, the decibel level was getting up there so bad that our house was basically shaking. That might be a little, but it was real. We couldn't hear our television. It's on the opposite side of our house. So we called the campgrounds. We didn't get an answer. We called another number they had. Didn't get an answer. What good is it to call if we can't get a hold of anyone?
That's for sure.
There's no question.
Well, I'm interested. If you're within a half mile, it seems like maybe during the race you'd go find somebody over there. But how many people are with? When you say there's several people, you're a half mile away. How many people are you saying are affected with noise levels?
There are 20 homes within 1 mile of this racetrack. Actually, one gentleman that couldn't make it has three young children. They bought a camper just to get out of the house on the weekends because their children cannot sleep. One of our neighbors can't even babysit for their children or their grandchildren because they can't sleep during races. And you're asking about a time limit, but when do you want to have people over for supper? You know, can we have a cookout? Well, I'm sorry, you have to wait till after 10 o'clock to come because that's when the race is over. To me, that's not having the proper use of my home, my yard. And to be honest with you, the Queenslands knew our stand on this when they bought the racetrack.
Ms. Gentleman, you said there's 20 homes within 1 mile of the track. Do you know whether all 20 homes, are they all opposed to the track, or are they all in opposition to this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I have never really...
You don't know?
I would say 90% of them were. To be honest with
but you,
we had sure. We had a petition. The racetrack can tell you they had one, too. But we had a petition going around in our area. There was over 120-some signatures that we got from these people. 90% of them were within hearing distance of this racetrack.
And on that petition, do you know those 20 homes, were they all on the petition, or don't you know? Or
I
you
can't
know?
Tell you right
okay.
off.
All right.
I can find out, though.
Very good.
Sure.
Further questions? Representative Dill.
Thank you. And to the witness, what was the petition about? You had a petition, but what did
all
it...
We asked
what was the purpose of the petition?
Well, Mr. Chairman, all we asked for on the petition was to please keep the noise limits within state regulations. That is it. They can race under racing and do whatever, you know, have their racing cars and stuff. We did not ask for a time limit. We just asked for the noise limits to be within the Minnesota state regulations. Actually, we did, or someone did talk to a gentleman up in Brainerd. He said there are mufflers you can put on the cars to get the noise down. But I couldn't get him a hold of him to ask him the specifics of that.
Okay, Representative Westrom, I don't know, did I cut you off or did you have further questions? I think you did.
I'm listening to him, I'm sure it is, but I, to Representative Nornes's issue, and I have Alexandria in my area, and within a mile of the racetrack, you would probably have several thousand people, and I'm just curious what is so different about this one, because I've been to the races, I've got relatives that live in Alexandria, more than a mile away, and it's just kind of it's an atmosphere that you expect in Alexandria on Saturday nights. My parents live some 10 miles, I don't know, maybe it's 7-8 miles, and you still hear them. So if your petition was signed by people that could hear the racetrack, it would probably be way beyond where the noise limits would even be above 90 decibels, but I'm wondering if there's something from here that's so much different than what the other tracks are, because in Alexandria they're building houses and duplexes and twin homes and condominiums all around the racetrack, and they're selling the property, and I don't know, you wouldn't build there if it's that undesirable, and I'm just wondering if there's, I'm just kind of scratching my head here, figuring out why this one's so much noisier.
And I understand. I agree with you. I don't get it.
Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Gibbons.
My whole point is that we have been living there for how many years? A lot of people that have lived around there have lived there longer than we have. So why do we have to endure this noise every night? I realize there's other racetracks in towns, everything else. But we live in the country. We don't live in town. I don't want the noise. I just want them to comply with what the Minnesota state laws are now. And I have another comment about if they take away this provision that no one can go after the nuisance law with racetracks, I'm sorry, but that is really, really bad, because what recall does any of us have if we don't have something like this?
Further discussion. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, do you happen to know, Mr. Chair, if someone's in the audience from the MPCA, any noise people?
Mm-hmm. I believe there are people in the audience, Representative McNamara, and I believe they'll be coming up.
Okay. I just have a question in that regard. I see there's a plan to do some corrective work, and I'm wondering the effect of that.
Very good. Further discussion of the witness. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you,
Mr. Anyone else that would like to speak in opposition to the bill? Anyone else that would like to speak in opposition to the bill? Please come forward. Okay. MPCA, is there somebody from MPCA that could just clarify a couple of issues? Thank you very much for coming forward. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, and maybe Representative McNamara might have a question for you.
Good evening, David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Pollution Control Agency.
Thank you very much. Representative McNamara, do you have a question?
Well, I know, Mr. Thornton, or Deputy Commissioner, did you happen to see that we were given a 2005 and a 2006 plan of action by the Deer Creek Speedway? And they make mention, have you seen this by chance?
I have not seen the plan.
Maybe somebody can bring it to you, but maybe just for the audience, I can read the part I'm wondering about. It says install a 16-foot high by 230-foot barrier, I would assume they mean an earthen berm, 15 feet from the track surface around turn 3 in the northeast corner of the track, construction that take place this spring. And I'm wondering what effect building a berm that would, I would imagine, block the direct movement of the noise.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, we haven't seen this plan, and so we can't speak specifically about what the berm or the wall or whatever it is they're planning to build would do. in general, there should be some reduction of noise, particularly nearer the facility as a result of that. Whether it's going to alleviate the noise that the woman that was just up here experiences, it's hard to know. We'd be more than happy to take a look at the plan and any consulting work that's been done and evaluate it and help out the racetrack or the county if they need some advice from us.
Representative McMahon, I believe it's a wall that they're going to be building.
Oh, wow. Well, I thought you'd build something natural, Mr. Chair, you know, made out of dirt or trees or something, rather than out of brick and mortar.
But, sell trees.
Right on. Deputy Commissioner, what about additional things, maybe some additional buffering, trees, additional wall or whatever? Does that have the effect of softening the noise level? Would your experience be that this is the kind of things that could be worked on to make it better?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, it's very difficult to build a wall that's big enough and effective enough to result in a noise-generating facility meeting the ambient air quality or the noise standards 24 hours a day. I think the issue here is what happens after 10 p.m. at night when the standards get tighter. That's why in the past the legislature's looked at exempting freeways, for example, from having to specifically meet the standards, even though fairly large noise walls can be found along many miles of the freeways in cities. The standards are still exceeded on the other side of those walls and in the neighborhoods around those, and there's really no way to effectively try to reduce the noise to a level that would meet the standards.
One last follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the effect of tree planting around the racetrack long-term, I know short-term it wouldn't necessarily be, but in the case of this where I noticed it's forested on the west side of this, would the homes in the forested area be substantially different impact on the noise as opposed to looks like to the east there's a house there that's wide open across.
We're talking
Chairman,
about tree guy here.
McNamara, the trees help a little bit.
Only a little.
A Thank little you. Bit.
He wants to bring a few in, Mr. Chair.
I think so.
Can you plant those big ones?
Yeah, we can
get enough root?
Yeah, we can handle it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, anything further? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the witness. An earlier witness had talked about alluded to the airport and noise insulation, and I know that not all homes are equal, but do you have an idea of what it would cost to insulate a home, maybe a standard home, to the 90 decibel level? What experience we might have with the airport there as a ballpark figure?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think that right now the going rate for the package of insulation that has been installed in South Minneapolis and some of the other communities is around $30,000 to $40,000. It very much depends on the size of the house, but that's a good ballpark figure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thornton, two questions. First of all, we've heard a little bit about other racetracks, and do you see complaints at the MPCA of violations at other racetracks, or has this been a unique occurrence at this one? And
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelleher, the Brainerd International Raceway is the other one that we've had complaints from. When we came into the room tonight, we thought that there was only this Deer Creek Raceway that was affected by extending the dates and learned that there were a couple more, and we haven't been getting any complaints from those.
And, Mr. Chair, I would like the MPCA to comment on the middle portion, which is the noise-generating activities exempted from state standards, and then we go into Section 561.03, Chapters 116B and 116D. You heard me earlier. I have a concern of how broad that is. I'd like to know the MPCA's perspective on how broad that is in terms of affecting
Mr. Chairman, Representative Keller, we looked at this and talked to the Attorney General's office this morning, and I think that your interpretation of that, of the way that the bill is written, is generally correct. Our specific interest pretty much ends at the period right after the date, and so we haven't really gotten too deep into those issues. I guess that would be appropriate for a civil law committee.
Mr. Chair, I want to say that I think that we're dealing a little bit with an issue here that is about people's ability to enjoy both activity and their homes. And I think that with that provision, we get into a property rights issue that I think, if you think eminent domain is a big deal, that section of law, my understanding looking at the statute book, and I think some other people might talk about this, has been around for a very long time in our state and gets into an ownership issue that is really uncomfortable. So.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I may have missed this. I was wondering what the decibel limit was compared to what would be at the airport, and I'm kind of wondering what the airport decibel limit is. And we're talking about 90 here. I may have missed this, but are you falling within the 90 decibels or not, or what are your decibels?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask Brian Timerson from our staff to try to help answer that question.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Brian Timerson. I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. Mr. Chair, Representative, the state noise rules are written significantly different than the rules that govern the airport. The state noise rules are based on two different measuring metrics, an L10 and an L50 measuring metric. Basically, the residential noise level limits for the daytime is 65 decibels for 10% of the hour. And for the daytime, defined as 7 a.m. to 10 p.m., for a more constant duration of 30 minutes out of an hour, is 60 decibels A-weighted. So, that being said, a noise level cannot be above 65 decibels for more than 6 minutes out of an hour on a residential receiver. During the night, which is defined by Minnesota rules as 10 p.m. to 7 a.m., the noise level limits become 10 decibels more restrictive, so they are an L10 of 55 decibels and an L50 of 50 decibels. So at night or after 10 p.m., the state noise level limit is 55 decibels.
Representative Spaulding.
And then what are the decibels at the racetrack? Did I miss that? I'm hearing 90, but I'm wondering, have they been measured at the racetrack, and which parameters does the racetrack fall under if it was built after 1983, which the present owners would have known about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalding, the state noise rules are a receiver-based standard. So they limit the amount of noise that can be observed at a point of normal human activity on the receiving property. So there is no limit for a racetrack. What the limits are based on is what the receiving property hears. If this racetrack was far enough away from any residential receivers, the noise level limit for a residential receiver wouldn't apply because you would not have any residences hearing that noise. So it's not a source-based standard. There's no limit for the racetrack. The limits are based on the receiving property and pertain to other noise sources such as a racetrack.
That's the deal.
Okay, I think I've followed all that. How many dB are the airplanes out off the end, a half a mile off the end of the runway at the airport then, if they're under? What kind of number are they at out there? I know you weren't talking about the airport standards. You were talking about residential standards. My second question would be, along an interstate, outside of those barrier walls, what kind of noise would you experience along an interstate, like in Representative Kelleher's district 394? What I'm just trying to get a feel for this. Airport and then along an interstate.
Ms. Anderson, can you answer that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, along interstates that are protected by noise walls, it's the goal of MnDOT to comply with the state noise rules. In some locations they can't because of topography or whatever. But you will get significantly different noise levels throughout a residential area, even if they are affected somewhat similarly by a highway. It's very difficult to say a highway, even with a noise wall, produces a certain decibel level. The noise walls are designed to comply with the state noise rules. Sometimes they don't. As far as your question about an aircraft, if you're talking about an aircraft a half mile away, that's another difficult thing. You could measure one at 50 decibels, you could measure one at 80 decibels. It depends on the aircraft, depends on the location, but 90 decibels is quite loud. It's difficult to get that loud of a noise level in most residential areas.
Any further discussion? Representative Poppin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had talked that you would be willing to work with the county and work with the neighbors and the Queenslanders on reducing the noise. Do you have some thoughts about what specifically could be done? Can the noise be reduced so that it's within the current limits, and what might be some of those suggestions that would be able to be done? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppy, I think that the most effective thing that could be done at this point would be addressing hours of operation.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming forward. Thank you very much. Very, very helpful. Okay. Further discussion of the bill.
Mr. Chair, are we about to vote?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say that I'm glad that the chair will be working with folks on the way to civil law. As the bill is written, the exemption from 560-101 touches a property law right that's been in Minnesota statute since prior to 1907. And I think we want to be really careful about taking personal property rights that come with the land when you purchase the land that have been in Minnesota statutes for that long. So with the chair's assurance that he's working on that provision, I think I can support the bill on its way out of here.
Thank you very much. I promise everyone on the committee and everybody in the audience I will be working on that issue. And if Mr. Brandenhoff would talk to Jack Perry, the attorney for the Queenland family, and come up with maybe some suggested language to change that. You heard the issue and can probably understand it, and talk with Mr. Perry and see if you can come up with some changes to the language. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to say I understand that racing is a family sport. I have been around friends and other family members who participate in it. I don't myself, but I do know that it's a family sport. Unfortunately, it is a noisy sport. And so I do appreciate that we've taken out the one little phrase in there, and that allows for more local control, because I think that that's another issue that the neighbors were concerned about as well. And I would hope that we can continue to work on this bill and make it so that it tries to fit the needs as best as possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further on the bill?
Yeah.
Seeing no further discussion, the chair renews his motion that House File 3496 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails.
No.
The bill is re-referred, and I should have said as amended on the bill. Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you, everyone. Representative McNamara. Members, we're going to finish up the game of fish bill today. Next on the agenda.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members. I do not have any handouts.
Why don't we wait for the room to clear out, Mr. McMahon? Wow, thank you everybody for coming. Thank you very much. See you, Bob.
He wasn't talking to you.
You're not that lucky.
They must have been racist.
Yeah, Matt, I bet you thought all those people were here.
For the game
it
is.
Members, we have... Okay. I think we just laid it over, didn't we? House File 3106. lead it over?
Yes, I do.
In the previous committee.
We'll bring House File 3116 back before us, and the chair will bring House File 3116 back before us, represent McNamara's bill. And members, we have a document that was put together with all the amendments all in one package, and I'd like to adopt that amendment before we proceed. These are things that we did in the previous committee when we talked about the Game and Fish Bill. So Representative McNamara moves the A06 1259 amendment to bring the bill in the shape that we were at in the last committee. So everybody in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative McNamara, where are we at today?
Well, Mr. Chair, do you want to start taking some of the amendments? I have Representative Cornish and I have been working on an issue that's important to many of us, especially in the more rural areas where you have to drag the deer for long ways. I think we've got consensus on it. Maybe we should have Colonel Hamm come down and confirm that we're on the same page.
Colonel Hamm or Bob Meyer, anybody from the DNR would like to come forward. This is an important issue, and I hope we've got it all worked up. Maybe the DNR can tell us exactly what the amendment does. Are you familiar with it, Colonel Hamm? Please state your name and who you represent, just for the record.
Colonel Mike Hamm, Chief Conservation Officer, Department of Natural Resources, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, I am familiar with the amendment. We've worked with the author, Representative Cornish, as well as the Deer Hunters Association. We've got a lot of time invested in it. One would think that when you're moving something from the simple words of kill site, that how could you possibly get to this length of verbiage?
Well, I can understand how that happens. I don't know if I move the amendment, but the chair moved the 18th amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What this does is it frames the issue so that any time a deer hunter, after shooting the deer, and they start dragging the deer out, and the deer is on the ground, whether the deer is on the ground being pulled by ropes or some kind of mechanical device like a wheel or a wheelbarrow or even being pulled by an ATV or even any other motor vehicle, when it's on the ground, it does not have to be tagged. And then when it gets to a vehicle, when it gets to a camp, when it is hung up, then the tag goes on. If for some reason somebody is dragging the deer out and they need more assistance, all they simply have to do is put the tag on the deer, go out and get their assistance, come back, take the tag off, because we don't have a sealed tag anymore. It's a tie-on tag, and for the process of pulling the deer out. So I think that it does clearly reach the objective that the Deer Hunters Association and other hunters are looking for, so that they don't end up losing their tag. The tag doesn't get pulled off when they're dragging it through the swamp, through the rocks, through the forest, whatever the case may be, Mr. Chair.
So, Colonel Hamm, so I shoot the deer, and I can drag it out to my vehicle before I put the tag on?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Well, if you shoot the deer, you will validate your tag.
Right, right.
Just like
that's
you do.
Right.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Just like you do by today.
Right.
That stays the same.
Right.
The only snapshot that we are dealing with is the actual physical dragging of the deer, where complaints come in about people losing that tag, because by today's standards it would have to be on there. But we're looking forward, and it just has to be on the person or somebody's person that's pulling this deer out. The officer comes up and says, hey, nice deer, can I see the validated tag? They reach into the pocket, pull it out, they've got it. Carry on.
Excellent. You know, I bought a sled this year, and I drug my deer out on the sled. There was no snow. But boy, was that nice to drag that deer out on that sled. You know, all these years I've been dragging that over all the trees and the grass and all that stuff, and just took a lot of the friction away.
Age and wisdom, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Even nicer we had a little snow, but any questions? On the amendment, A10 amendment. All in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Thank you, Colonel Hamm. Thank you very much for working on that for us. Okay, what do I got here? Hackbarth amendment, A11 amendment. Mr. Bogus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Ed Bogus with DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife, and this is an amendment that we had asked the chairman to offer that just clarifies that when we post spawning areas or areas that we're using for taking spawn or other management purposes, that we've had long-standing authority in law to post these areas, and we've been posting these areas, but we've discovered that we need a clear exemption from rulemaking when we decide which of these to post and which not to post. So the changes on page 2 of the amendment, lines 11 through 13, where it just makes it clear that when we do this posting, we don't have to go through a separate rulemaking. This type of posting is done on short notice. There's a determination as the ice is going out where the fish are concentrating and where we need to do the posting. So this is just a clarification of the process that we use to do the posting, and it's consistent with past practice of protecting these areas in the springtime.
Looks like an amendment that the commissioner would like.
Mr. Chairman, that's a good guess. That's true. He's a stickler for these types of things.
Any questions on the A11 amendment? Seeing none, the chair will move the A11 amendment. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Thank you, Mr. Bogus. Okay, what are we there next? All your amendments, my name on them. Who's got this one? Who's doing it?
You.
Mr. Bogus? The A13 amendment.
Mr. Chairman and members, again, this is an amendment that we identified a need as we were working on a fisheries rule. We've had requests from some of the stakeholder groups that we, by rule, allow some quick strike rigs, which is a type of rigging of a live bait that utilizes more than one hook, and the musky anglers in particular have indicated that this would allow for quicker hooking and healthier release of fish. And currently, law doesn't give us authority to do a rule that would allow that type of a rig to be used. We're working on a rule. We've been working with the musky fishing interests on that rule, but in the process of reviewing that rule, we've discovered that we don't have clear authority to promulgate it. So this would give us authority to authorize that type of a live bait rig or other similar types of things that the commissioner might prescribe by rule. We still would have to go through the full Chapter 14 administrative procedure. Have to go through the full Chapter 14 administrative procedures process and potential public hearings and that type of thing.
Mr. Bogus, I'm not going to have some fishing groups in here in a couple of years after me mad because we changed this.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that they're the ones that are asking for us to
change
the rule.
Okay, Representative Hackbarth moves the A13 amendment. Does everybody understand the amendment? All those in favor of the A13 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevailed. Amendment's adopted. What do we got next? Representative Pence.
I worked with Colonel Hamm on this, and hopefully it's satisfactory. It's page 5, line 10. So it's not line 2, it's line 10. And this
is... Representative Pennis, it's page 5, line 10 is where the amendment should be.
Right? Yes.
Okay, Representative Pennis incorporates that in an amendment.
And this is very similar, or I don't know if it's identical, but to the language that is now in the Senate bill. And so it would say it's $500 if the animal is killed by the dog and $100 if a dog continuously pursues the animal. And the other thing I just want to add is the conservation officer is always at the discretion of making a call on whether to cite that person or not. But if he does, then he has got something definite. And I think that's what we wanted to go. So
you're happy.
I'm okay.
Okay.
Taffy, I'm never.
That's as good of a guess.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesher, I'd quickly support Representative's Dennis's happiness. So I actually like the modified language.
Very good. Any further discussion on the A-15 amendment? Representative Dennis moves the A-15 amendment. Colonel Ham, we're okay? Okay.
Aye.
All in favor of the A-15 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails, and A-15 is adopted. Are you okay with them, McNamara?
Just got to check the plane.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
You're doing good.
We'll take care of the bill for you.
Yeah. I'm worried, no.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesher,
I believe the language for evening out the swearing and fishing boats is in this bill also, isn't it?
Yep.
So?
Yep.
Okay.
Get that all taken care
of? Okay. I'm just reading an email of a constituent who wants that changed, so Mr. Chair, I thought I'd verify that was still in the bill.
Okay. Representative Hanson. Representative Hanson moves the A-14 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do have a couple corrections after talking with DNR.
Okay, what are they?
Where it says a conservation officer, that should be...
Okay, on the last line.
On 1.5, that should say the commissioner.
Delete a conservation officer?
Yes.
And insert...
The commissioner.
The commissioner. Everybody have that?
And then the second one is... 48 hours instead of 24, so it's more realistic for weekends.
Everybody understand that? Representative Hanson incorporates that change in those amendments?
Mr. Chair, the 48 hours, what is that for?
Well, we're going to hear Representative Hanson's explanation of the amendment now that he incorporated the changes into his amendment. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a small amendment following up on our fact sheet that was provided by House Research, where it was stated that there are increasing occurrences in the field of non-native species of deer, parentheses such as fallow deer, sika deer, etc., that have escaped from captivity being found living in the wild in Minnesota.
Oh, yeah.
And so we are changing the definition of deer to mean white-tailed and mule deer, and my amendment states that a hunter legally taking a deer that is not a white-tailed or mule deer must report the type of deer taken to the commissioner within 48 hours of taking. The purpose of the amendment is to get a better handle on how much of the non-native deer are occurring in Minnesota, and so we have more information looking at that particular concern where we have non-native and invasive wildlife. And I did meet with DNR, as I mentioned in the amendment to make some changes on that, and I did meet with Representative McNamara as well, who had co-signed the amendment.
Mr. Herrand, when we say the commissioner, where this would be placed in law, is that appropriate for the DNR commissioner? Or do we need to state the Department of Natural Resources commissioner?
I think we should. It's not codified, so we should put the Commissioner of Natural Resources to ensure that that's the right commissioner.
Okay, Representative Hanson incorporates that in his amendment. Discussion to the amendment. Representative Lesher.
Quick question, Representative Hanson. Friday night, 6 p.m., you take this deer, you have to notify him by Sunday night, 6 p.m.? Does that work with 48 hours?
I was hoping that 48 would cover that. I realize that I'm flexible on...
I'm just wondering how 72 would cover the whole...
72,
Representative Westrum, I think when we put the commissioner in there, and the DNR can testify to this, I think it would be a conservation officer. But we took out conservation officer because we didn't want it to be just a conservation officer. Mm-hmm. It could be a park ranger or anybody from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Right.
And when you put in the commissioner of Department of Natural Resources.
All right, they can testify. I'm just wondering, who would you call? I mean, who would you find on a weekend that's a fairly...
August, Colonel Ham, when he has Deputy Commissioner...
Mr. Chairman and Representative Westrum and Representative Hanson, what we were thinking we would do on this is put something in the regulations booklet that would ask people to call our information number, so there could be a problem They could leave a message on there, or they could email us or whatever, but I don't know that it's urgent that we hear about these, so if 3 days or 4 days gives more comfort, I think from our perspective that would still be fine.
I'm okay with 72.
Representative Hanson, how about 72 hours?
I'm fine with 72.
72 hours.
Mr. Chair, my thoughts are when you're hunting in the remote woods like where we do, you could be out there for 5 days. We're going to make them make a special trip. In the registering of the deer, we allow them 24 hours after the end of season.
Okay, we're referring the bill to the Finance Committee? DevOps, and then to the Finance?
So we can...
Can we work on something before it gets to the Environment Finance Committee?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Hanson withdraws the A14 amendment. Thank you. Okay, what's next?
Right.
Did we do something for the 50? Okay. I'm going to have an amendment for 50 hunters when we get to the Finance Committee, Representative Osmond. It's a policy issue. It's a little change. We didn't get it taken care of before this committee hearing. Sure, no
problem. Mr. Chair, if I could...
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do want to, if you're going to be dealing with the turkeys, I have been meeting with the Roger Houck and the Challenged Hunters, and if you remember right...
Partners?
Yeah, when you had the special hearing we had up in Camp Ripley a mm-hmm. year or two ago, and Representative Blaine helped craft language that allowed for the capable hunters to do some turkey hunting in Camp Ripley. Well, it's come to be that hunting is being limited to just the veterans, and I guess I would like to have the department work and see if it was our original intent that the capable partners would be able to hunt there.
Absolutely. I mean, what happened there?
Well,
I know.
Mr. Chair, it just came to my attention. I'm wondering if it would be possible to be working on it, maybe by the time it gets to the Representative Osmond's committee.
Absolutely. Yep. We've got to fix that.
Yep.
Is that okay with you, Roger? Okay. We got to get that back on track.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Members, yesterday we passed House File 3353. This was the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association bill that fixed the area of ATVs and deer hunting, the problem that we had, people hunting or having a hunting license and driving ATVs on their own private land, and that fix that we did. And I would like to incorporate that in the Game and Fish bill. I've talked to Representative McNamara about it, and he agrees, and I think we're okay with it. Anybody from the DNR or any other discussion before the committee on that issue?
We didn't have any amendments at all onto this. Oh, you added those amendments in here.
Oh, that's right. Is it in? The amendment will include the word snowmobile in the areas of... Okay. Yes, we did add...
Amended.
Oh, as amended, okay.
Okay, so this, Mr. Chairman, is as amended, and you're going to incorporate.
Very good.
Good.
Okay. So the chair would move that House File 3353, as amended, be incorporated in the Game and Fish Bill. That would be my motion. Any further discussion? All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Who's is this? Oh, this is the Representative Pennis's bill for the Type 1, Type 2 off-road vehicles to be included in the Game and Fish Bill. Representative McNamara? Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Representative Chair, members, we had previously discussed this.
Representative Pennis?
That's just fine.
And, Mr. Chairman, same question.
We're going to move as amended.
As amended. Okay.
So, Representative Pennis moves House File 3614 as amended to be included in the Game and Fish Bill. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion prevails. Anything else? We're good?
Yes.
Representative McNamara.
Mr. Chair, just a couple things. If I could have Chief of Fisheries Ron Pryor would like to
Where's he been hiding? I haven't seen him back there.
Well, I think he's hiding here somewhere, Mr. Chair and members. He just wanted to speak a little bit about the contest rules, and then if I could have the deputy commissioner, I would like to ask the deputy commissioner a question just in regards to some pheasant hunting while the committee's here and while he's so gracious to be in attendance.
You better get a leg hold on him or something before he sneaks out here.
Yeah, not on the gracious part.
Please state your name when you represent the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Ron Pyer with DNR Fish and Wildlife. And on page 10, subdivision 4, that deals with tournament changes, there's a change there that would say to minimize user conflicts. And I wanted to bring attention to the committee that the Bass Federation has some concerns with that language. They think it's too broad. And I talked to Vern Wagner ahead of time. So what we've done is we've committed to meet with Mr. Wagner and members of the Federation and see if we can do a better job of maybe having a better definition of what user conflicts are. So I told Vern I would make sure the committee was aware of those concerns, and we will work with them over the next few days and see if we can develop some alternative language.
And Mr. Byer, could you tell us exactly where that was again?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. It's on page 10, line 10.2. And it says to minimize user conflicts, and they just thought that was too broad. They weren't sure what that really meant, and so
okay.
we've committed to work with them to see.
So we're not going
to
make a change at this time, but something will be coming forward in one of the next meetings.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Anything further?
Deputy Commissioner, Mr. Chair.
You don't want to come up,
Mr. Chair. I'd ask.
He doesn't have a choice.
Come up. Oh, here he is. Mr. Chair and members, I just would like to ask the Deputy Commissioner about Minnesota is, I believe, unique in with the two Dakotas and Iowa that we do not allow the taking of three rooster pheasants. And biologically, I don't know the reason why we wouldn't want to consider that, especially later in the season. I believe a lot of our people are leaving the state of Minnesota, even though now we have real good pheasant hunting, to go to the other states because it limits their amount of time in the field. And I guess I'd just like to hear what the agency has to say.
Mr. Chair, members, Mark Olson, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. My response to Representative McNamara would be, well, pheasant hunting in the state, as it has improved greatly over the last couple of years, it is a recent phenomenon, and we're still dealing with the effects of and the cultural effects of the decimation of the pheasant range and the pheasant population in Minnesota, although it has rebounded in the last handful of years very well. The agency has been talking about and looking at different changes in the pheasant limits and discussions of three pheasants going to a three pheasants or going to an eight bird possession are some of the discussions that we have been ongoing.
Mr. McNamara.
Well, and Deputy Commissioner, what about, I know sometimes we're trying to not make it a complicated world, but isn't the reality if we let the first weeks or month maybe only have two and allow the later season to go to three, would have pretty limited effect on the numbers? I'm wondering if you would consider that opportunity.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara and members, you are somewhat correct in the earlier statement of saying that it had limited biological effect by raising it 2-3 and concentrating on roosters, but making sure that the population or the harvest is spread out throughout the entire year has been where the agency has been. I don't know if we have considered a specific proposal of concentrating a three-bird limit to the last half of the season. I don't know if we've considered it in that light.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative McNamara makes me think of another question for the Commissioner, and I'm so glad.
See what you did now, Denny.
What?
I'm just kidding.
I think I missed something.
Yeah.
Do you have plans, or do you have the authority to
to deal with a major bird flu epidemic in Minnesota. And could you just share those plans?
Chair, Representative Aguinius, yes, we do a lot of surveillance activities right now at our WMAs, at our refuges, and other areas. And it's not a new phenomenon for the department. As we have looked for other diseases, botulism, boy, there were a couple others, I just can't come up from off the top of my head, that we are constantly out monitoring and surveying the wild population, specifically the waterfowl. We are, as the agencies, as the state is gearing up for the bird flu situation, I believe there is some additional funding coming in the governor's proposal for the agency to gear up even more to be able to be a first responder in the wild if or when avian flu does come to the state.
Representative Gideon.
Well, thank you. I know the federal government is going to do a lot more checking in Alaska this year, but I think really my question was more to, if we find a flu situation, can you then, do you have the authority to just to limit hunting seasons just on that basis? Representative McNamara is thinking of a lot more birds, and I am thinking you're in the middle of duck season or some hunting season, and you are seeing a decimation of the population. Do you have the authority to say, folks, we've just got to quit right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Aguinius, it's my understanding that we do have that authority to suspend or close the season due to those types of situations.
Anything further for the commission?
Mr. Chair, just to point out, if we were to follow the legislative authority given to us, we'd be shooting up to 2 hens and 5 birds a day.
That's not good.
We don't want to shoot hens.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative McNamara, anything further?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything from the audience? Anybody else have any comments on the bill, on the Game and Fish Bill, House File 3116 as amended? See no further discussion. Representative McNamara removes his motion that House File 3116 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Veterans Affairs. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails, and the bill is re-referred. Good luck, Representative McNamara. Members, I do have a couple of announcements. Tomorrow we will be meeting in this room, room 10, at a regularly scheduled time at 12:30. This room, room 10, 12:30 tomorrow, and we'll be bringing up the governor's mercury reduction bill. That will be the entire meeting. It will be on the governor's mercury reduction bill. Oh, and Representative Horton's bill.
Mr. Chair, do you have copies of the bill we'll be discussing tomorrow?
I don't have nothing right now, but we do have them.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yep. They'll be in everyone's packet tomorrow. Also members, GEO caucus members, will be meeting tomorrow morning at 7:30 a.m. in room 454. Meeting adjourned.